Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rich Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, going to be talking about the Pennsylvania House. Republicans have unveiled their, they've unveiled their version of the No Rights at Work agenda. Again, I mean, this is nothing new. They do it every new session. So here we are today, again, going after workers' rights, going after the ability to collective bargaining, and all those collections of people, those evil unions, yeah, you know, those collections of people, yeah, going to go after those. Also going to talk about falling in line with Pennsylvania. Virginia decided to take to the back door in its attempt to steal the 2016 election. We'll talk about that. Today marks the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Your thoughts on that as well. In addition to the U.S. House of Representatives, the Republicans, they got a plan. They're going to suspend the debt ceiling until May 19th. That seems to be the plan. I'm kind of wondering what scheme they're running. What's the end game here? We'll find out about that. Also, the rich and famous. Well, they're whining and crying in California and really around the world over having to pitch in. You know, hey, you made tons of money and, well, screw you, I'm going. So we'll talk about that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therichsmithshow.com. So the big controversy, did Beyonce lip sync? Did she lip sync? Did she play along to a recorded little thing? I say yes, and the Marine Corps band says yes, and there are a lot of people who say yes. But hey, that's big controversy. And the sad reality is that seems to be what the capacity of our mainstream media. That's the big thing. And, you know, I was at the inauguration, and it's one of those moments where even if it were, you know, Romney being inaugurated, I probably would have gone, because to me it's that moment of civic engagement. It's that being an American and really that proud tradition of the inauguration. And it made me think about, you know, one of the first transfers of power. And, you know, they talk, and I think it was, I think Schumer brought it up, in talking about the, you know, the transfer of power and George Washington being asked, you know, about the country. And he said, you know, it's going to be who's the second president. And for me, it was that moment when Adams relinquished reins to Jefferson, and you had the change of ideology, just like you had when Bush left office and Obama took over. That peaceful transition of power, that moving the country forward. It's not about the people. It's not about those people standing on the stage. It's about the people. And if you listen to Obama's address. He emphasized, and I liked the way, there were some things I liked about it, some things I didn't. You know, I've got my problems with Obama like a lot of folks. If it were Mitt Romney, you know, it would be what it would be. It's Obama. It's going to be what it's going to be as well. But I liked the way he emphasized the people. Because at the end of the day, it is really all about the people. All of us collectively. And the question then becomes, is how do we move forward, all of the people, and in a direction that's positive for the nation? Because what we've got right now, and look, he tried to be centrist. I'm a little less centrist. The right wing believes we're a center-right nation. I believe we've been told we're a center-right nation, but when you talk to people about policy, you talk to them about what they want, what they see the future of the country, we're a center-left nation. We believe in Social Security, Medicare. We believe in taking care of the least among us. We believe in public education. Now, understand, the wealth class of this country is doing an amazing job of funding talking heads and ad agencies to run advertisement to tell us we're not. But most people, those institutions, they believe in. And even honest conservatives who aren't the radicals, who aren't the extremists, who aren't on someone's payroll, understand that, you know, we want income security. We want health security. We want retirement security. We want those things that really stopped us from a depression in 2008. The question is, how do we come forward? And while I was at the inauguration, and I got to be honest, I had fantastic. I was three rows away from where the president gave his inaugural address, just in front of the Marine Corps band there. And it was an amazing moment. It, you know, one of those things that just kind of, you know, is this real? I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I never thought I would live to 30, let alone ever have a career and own a home and have a family and do a lot of the things that I've been so fortunate to do. Never in a million years that I think I would be at something like that in that situation. It was remarkable. But in the end, as one of the folks who I did a number of interviews while I was there, as one of the people asked me, what do you want? What do you want from this person? What do you see? What does he need to do? And I said pretty simply, he needs to be the leader. He needs to get up and say, you know what? This is the way we're going. This is why you follow me. And this is how we get things done. And this is how we hold the Republicans accountable. And I saw a lot of folks who were walking around with, you know, with signs saying the dream's been realized, and, you know, Dr. King was, you know, has been his vision realized. And I went up and asked a couple, do you really believe that? Do you really believe that the dream has been realized? Because I don't. I don't believe the dream has been realized because we still have major gaps in those who have and those who don't. Now, I'm not saying we're ever going to be truly equal, but we are now more unequal than we were then, both socially and economically. And there are some things that are coming in the right direction. Like I just saw a report from the National Center on Education Statistics that looked at the information from the class of 2010 and said, look, you know, we're at the highest level since 1974 of students graduating on time. In fact, 78%. But here again, you go back to Dr. King's dream. Are we equal when 83% of whites graduate from high school on time and 66% of African Americans do? 69% of American Indians and Alaskan Natives graduate on time? 71% of Hispanics? Are we equal? Are we there? And then you look at the divisions between the states. I mean, you've got a state like Nevada had the lowest graduation rate in the country. A state like Vermont had the highest. Places like New Hampshire and Idaho had the lowest dropout rates, while you had Mississippi had the highest dropout rate. Are we really realizing the dream when you have that kind of inequality? And really just in regions. I mean, you look around here. Can you imagine? And I had a friend of mine ask me once, you know, what would happen? What would happen to the fabric of our nation if those areas that are graduating barely at 50%, those areas that are graduating kids at 40%, suddenly hit the 80, 90% and wanted to go to college and wanted and demanded those good paying jobs? And we're given the critical thinking skills. What would happen to this country? And I think about that quite often. What would happen if we had truly a society that sat and, you know, said, hey, you know, what we're being spoon-fed, all of this media nonsense, all of the, oh, did Beyonce lip-sync as the biggest problem of the day? What would we be demanding if we had not just, you know, 74% of people graduating from high school, but 90, 95%? And what if those people in the inner city started saying, you know what, we want to go to college and we want a shot at that American dream? Well, the wealth class wouldn't like that because they would have to pay their fair share. And I talk about education because it's important. 66% of African Americans graduating on time, that's a national disgrace. And it has, in my view, everything to do with poverty. And I would guarantee you, you look at the 83% of whites who graduate on time, I'll bet you a large portion of those are in affluent areas, in the places where you have high poverty. It doesn't matter, black or white. You're going to have a lower number. So is the dream really realized for everyone? Because I don't look at King's dream as solely the dream of African Americans. I think it's for everybody. This dream that no matter what, it's the content of your character and your ability. It's an opportunity for everyone. And Obama said, you know, our journey's not complete until our wives or mothers and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts. Are we truly equal? Do we have economic justice? Do we have that floor? And the answer is no. Now, I have an answer for that. Like, I have an answer for most of these things. But it's got to take the political will. The one thing I didn't hear Obama talk about is he talked about some, you know, building roads, and he talked about, you know, equality. He talked about, you know, the LBG community. He talked about, from Seneca Falls to Selma to Stonewall. You know, that hit a lot of the women's rights, the civil rights, and the gay and lesbian rights movements. What about workers? What about the economy? What about the jobs? What about making sure that we have opportunity for everybody? And, you know, I look at this, and for me, there's a lot of work to be done. And 4 years ago when the president took the oath of office, I said, you know, my goal for him was that he would be the one to reward work in this country. He would be the one to say, you know what, if you go to work, you punch the clock, you bust your behind, you do your time, you're going to be able to make a decent living. You're going to have the opportunity that my grandparents' generation had. You're going to have that hope that he talked about 4 years ago. And look, I was one of them. When I came on board and I said, you know, okay, I wasn't a huge, I'm still not a huge fan, but I wasn't really a big supporter at first. Not that I ever really have been. But okay, I bought the hope thing. We need that hope as a nation. We need to have that ability to say, okay, we're gonna turn things around. And we're gonna move forward, and we're gonna give workers the ability to collective bargaining, and, you know, cause the Employee Free Choice Act was possible. I want that reward for work returned. He's gonna be the guy who saves work in this country. Saves capitalism, saved the bankers, saved Wall Street, did a good job of doing that. Now it's time to save the workers. And I'd hoped that for him 4 years ago. I hope the same thing, you know, because I believe in equality. I believe that, you know, our journey, as he points out, is not complete until our wives, mothers, and daughters earn an equal living with him. But how do you do that? Well, I think you do that with contract. A commitment. And he talked about commitments. You know, he said the commitment we make to each other through Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, they don't sap our initiative. He said they strengthen us, and I agree. And he hit that what the right has been thrown at. Oh, all these people who are on Social Security, they're takers. And Obama said, that doesn't make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great. Because, you know, you don't hear anybody other than me talking about bankruptcy reform, do you? You know, we got to be going after these big companies who abuse the bankruptcy laws. The Mitt Romneys of the world and the very wealthy of the world who manipulate the bankruptcy code. Seems to me to be a good place to start. Going after the corporate criminals who have crashed our, not a bad idea. But what he's going to have to do in this second term, I mean, because he's freed from having to run for re-election. He can now, if he truly is the liberal that the radical right wing keeps painting him as, now's the time where he can stand up and say, you know what, I'm not constrained by 4 years from now. I'm going to set the agenda. I'm going to have a legacy of standing up and fighting for workers and fighting for the middle class, if that truly is his calling, if that truly is who he is. And for me, a big message in what he is going to do over the next 4 years will be who he appoints the Secretary of Labor. It's going to be very interesting to see what name pops out of that and some of the things that come out of that and where we go with this next couple of months. I want to see a big jobs plan. I want to see a recommitment to manufacturing and infrastructure. That's how we're going to move the country forward. We need to cut deficit. No, nonsense. Because you know what? Our deficits are going down. They're going down on their own. And if you get people back to work, you turn the economy around, they will go down on their own. And that's something the radical right doesn't want to lose. You know, they don't want to lose a good opportunity. It's a good crisis is a good opportunity to get what they want. And this collapse, you know, the Bush collapse had given them the greatest opportunities to steal back wages, to steal back working conditions, to steal back benefits, to destroy safety nets, to go after unemployment, to go after workers' comp, and to go after pensions and sell everything off at dirt prices, which is exactly what we've seen the right do for the last several years. And we're going to continue to see until you have a leader who says, done, no more. Anyway, going to get your thoughts on the inauguration, on the direction of the nation, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Curious your thoughts right back after this. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As the nation honored Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy on Monday, the labor movement and the civil rights movement commemorated the solidarity that they share in the struggle for justice. In Memphis, during the sanitation workers' strike, just before an assassin's bullet struck him down, Dr. King talked about dignity for workers in Memphis and in the United States.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor.
In 1968, Dr. King told SEIU 1199 members that he walked many picket lines for justice for workers. He said solidarity and struggle is what will win social and economic justice for workers.
Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. We are going to demand what is ours. My friends, the resources are here in America. The question is whether the will is here. If we will stand and work together, we will bring into being that day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
At Wisconsin's commemoration of Dr. King, the widow of the late former father James Groppi criticized Governor Scott Walker for his attack on unions as she accepted an award for her late husband. Margaret Rozga spoke as the governor sat nearby.
As the widow of a man who, after we married, not only drove bus but became the president of Local 998 Amalgamated Transit Union, as a person who remembers that Martin Luther King was killed while he was working to organize sanitation workers, I know that anyone who works to curtail union rights is not in the tradition of Martin Luther King.
Coca-Cola workers in Germany are spilling out of their plants and onto picket lines to protest flexible working hours. Jesse Russell reports.
Flexible working hours and better wages have Coca-Cola employees walking the picket lines all across Germany. The workers are engaging in a series of warning strikes in advance of continued contract negotiations with the company. The strikes are taking place at the 50 Coca-Cola bottling plants throughout Germany. The union has called the strikes in protest of the threat of staff reductions and the introduction of flexible working hours, which could include mandatory weekend shifts. Negotiations are set to continue on January 30th, but so far there's been little sign of movement from the company. The workers are represented by the Beverages and Catering Industry Trade Union, which has argued that the plant workers have sacrificed by going years without wage increases.
You've been listening to
WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Working Class Radio Experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a living, wish you had a farm to raise. Father, son, left to carry on, blue devil, hell is great. Oh, 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 he's a working class man.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, the guy who heads up the Mon Valley Republican Committee, right here in the good old state of Pennsylvania, a guy named Brett Kovac, he decided, it'd be a good idea if we take the American flag, flip it upside down, and put it on the building there. And some folks not happy about it. In fact, Channel 11, a woman named Julie Fine went out and talked to him, and according to her, he said he doesn't regret doing it at all because he claims that our nation's in a horrible place. The statement that was attributed to him, he said, I think some people that didn't know why the flag was flying upside down might find out. And some people that didn't agree with it, they might have talked to somebody who agreed with it. So it's a good thing we did it. Now, I've seen a number of these upside down flags. In fact, my daughter asked me about one. I forget where we were going, but did you see that, Dad? And I said, yeah, I'll bet he's a Tea Party guy who's just not happy that the black guy is still in the White House. I actually saw someone hanging a chair from a flagpole. Had no idea what it meant until someone said, well, that's the Tea Partiers who are Clint Eastwood fans. Because if you remember the RNC, the Republican National Convention came out with the empty chair, kind of that. So you got to give them credit, at least a little creativity. Didn't want to be known for being a complete and total idiot for hanging the flag upside down. Didn't want to really tick off the neighbors, but still wanted the secret handshake, the insider little thing. So they hung the empty chair. Yeah. You want to know why we're really in trouble in this country? I mean, really honestly and truthfully, if you really think that we're distressed, especially my Tea Party friends, especially the working class Tea Party friends of mine, who, like me at the very beginning of the movement, the well-funded grassroots, quote-unquote, movement, I at the very beginning was right there, like a lot of the folks who initially were outraged and angered, because, you know, all the things that I was told as a kid growing up, you work hard, you play by the rules, you're going to be all right. Social Security will be fine. Medicare will be there to take care of you when you get older. All of these commitments that Obama talked about in his speeches that now the Republicans are painting folks who are getting these benefits as takers, those were the rewards for years of hard work, for dedication and commitment to the quote-unquote free enterprise system. These were the things that made you show up to those crummy jobs and made you... You know, willing to break your back and ruin your health to make a day's living, because you knew at the end there was going to be something there. You knew that your pension would be there. You'd have the Social Security, maybe a little savings. You could live out your golden years without fear of want or worry, without having to worry about if am I going to have food on the table or medicine. You didn't worry about that as much, because generations past said, you know what, we want to make sure of that. And I had lunch with a friend of mine who pointed out that, you know, one of the most crooked, arm-twisting, backroom dealers, in the history of the country is the guy who got us the Civil Rights Act, the guy who pushed through the Great Society and helped the least among us. And he has a legacy of standing up for minorities and the poor, and really, if you think about it, push towards that Christian nation status. Now, the hope is, the president we have will take that mantle up and go forward with it. But you look at the opposition, and this is where, I thought yesterday we need to have the guy who's going to come out swinging. And a lot of reports I saw, Obama's got a steely spine and all this. And I'm hoping that's the case. I'm hoping he comes out and tells him what is. And tells Boehner, I'm the president. I'm the one that's going to be the legacy here, not you. I don't think very many people remember who the Speaker of the House was during the Johnson years or the FDR years or the Lincoln years. They remember who the president was. They remember who the guy at the top was, the guy who set the agenda and said, this is where we're going. And that was part of my complaint about the first term. The whole health care thing should have been a dictate, not go do something. And I understand, go do something is how it's supposed to work. Legislation emanates from the House. Okay, get that. In this day and age, in the current environment, that leadership, that directive, that direction has to come from the president. And the hope is that we see some of that. We've given too much power to a too few. And I look at today here in the state of Pennsylvania. You saw the radicals on the right wing again. The No Rights at Work agenda front and center. The well-funded radical right pushing what they're calling the open workforce initiative. Sounds nice, doesn't it? We have an open workforce. Everyone's free to come and go. They're free to work and free to, it's open. And it's an initiative, of course, which kind of gives you the thought that we're going to create jobs, right? It's like the whole no rights at work thing. It's all like the whole right to work thing. Well, what right do we have? Oh, none. Is there any work attached to it? No. So what right to work do I have? Well, none. The rights all go to the employer. The rights all go to the moneyed interest. The rights all go to those at the top. And, of course, the work, well, especially the low-paid work, to those fortunate enough to get it. So all of these components of the No Rights at Work agenda, and it's a laundry list of wishful thinking by the wealth class and, well, things that they fund well, in going after and destroying our education, our health care, what few labor laws we have left. So six pieces of legislation put forth, most of them put forth 2 years ago by Metcalf and his band of radicals. And I'm not going to go through them because it's more of the same. It's the death of 1,000 paper cuts. We're not going to let the state collect dues. The unions are going to have to do that on their own. We're not going to make people join the union, even though you don't have to currently. It's a lot of nonsense. One of the scary ones, though, to me. And while the Metcalf bills and those four from last time are not going to pass, because they are radical, and the people in this state are not going to put up with it. The one put forth by Stephen Bloom, who happens to be my representative, kind of worries me, because there's the thought that, well, it's not as radical as the other ones. But the reality is, it's just as destructive. Oh, it's not as extreme as the other ones, but it gets to the same ends. It's not as far out and it's not as bad. Yeah, it is when it's in effect. And, you know, for people who love to talk about, oh, we believe in contracts, it's amazing on how the folks who believe in contracts don't believe in it for workers. How the people believe in collections of money, in the collaboration of money, don't believe in the collaboration of workers. I mean, it's pretty amazing to me. And, you know, you look at it and you go, well, you know, over the last several years, you've seen this consolidation of power into the hands of these huge, big companies. And what I love is I hear these folks, you know, like the Blooms and the Metcalfs, you know, they just want to destroy these little companies and put people out of business, which is could not be further from the truth. You know, I go back to history and some of the great leaders of the past who saw things into the future. And I think about Gompers, who said, you know, it should be criminal for a corporation not to make a profit. Because someone's mismanaging things. And the reality is you look at these big corporations who are sitting on trillions of dollars. And where'd they get them? Well, they got them from taxpayers. But they got it mostly from their workers. Because they were able to steal back years of hard-fought gains. So what is something like Metcalf and Bloom and all of this whatever initiative that they've schemed up, what was this going to do? it's going to allow the ones who are sitting on the trillions to sit on multiple trillions. And where's it going to come from? Well, it's going to come from workers. It's going to come from you. It's going to come from me. It's going to come from our neighbors. And what does that mean? It means more spiraling down. And for me, the way we turn this economy around, and the hope is at some point we wake up to that reality, especially on the national level. But the sad thing is, you know, labor has been tied to the Democratic Party because they've got nowhere else to go. The Republicans are insane when it comes to worker issues. They are bought and paid for by the business class. That's who funds their campaigns. Not that the business class doesn't fund the Democratic campaigns, but, you know, not to the extent. So labor has one place to go at this point. And that's with the Democrats, who aren't always their friends. For me, what has to happen is we have to come back together and get to the streets. And I've been saying this for a while, which is why when I saw this this analysis of population data by a guy named Matt Bruning, who pointed out that since the early 1970s, the number of strikes that have gone on in this country, the number of labor disputes, you know, people taken to the picket line, where there were 1,000 or more workers, went from I think it was, you know, 1976 through 79, something like, 289 work stoppages. And by the 1990s, it had fallen to, 35 per year, down from almost 290 in the 70s, down to just 5 in 2009. And, you know, this professor at Fordham University pointed out that, you know what, you look at our labor law today, it's really tilted to the business class. What he said is we've essentially gone back to pre-New Deal era workplace governance. And I've been saying that for a while. What we're back at is we're back before the Wagner Act. And until we take to the streets and until we say enough already, like we're seeing with our Walmart people, like we're seeing with the fast food workers in New York and Chicago, like we saw with the teachers in Chicago, until we do that, until we stand up and say no more, things are going to continue. So when Obama says something like our journey's not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn an equal living to their efforts, what does that mean? Does that mean that the wages of men have to come down to women? I would prefer it to be the other way around. So we've got work to do. For me, again, the answer's contract. Every CEO in this country's got one. Why doesn't every worker? Simple stuff to me. But yet, what do we hear out of the radical right? Oh, we got to eliminate, make it illegal for teachers to go on strike. How many teacher strikes do you have in Pennsylvania? One? Two, maybe? But boy, when there is one, because, and like we're seeing with the APSCA folks, and the PASHI universities, the chancellor here in the Commonwealth has been completely outrageous. There's no deal that he's going to take. He's doing what corporate America has been doing it and getting away with. You'll take what I give you and you'll get nothing more. There's no negotiating, there's no talking, and there's no input from you. Sit down, shut up, do what you're told to do, or we will crush you. How much longer are American workers going to put up with that? That, my friends, that's the question. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
The once haughty Tea Party has been whittled down to only a nub of its former self, with only 8% of Americans now identifying themselves with a faction. And no wonder. The fiery movement that sprang from legitimate anger over the government bailout of Wall Street banksters quickly got co-opted by Republican political operatives fronting for those same banksters and for such corporate extremists as the Koch brothers. By brandishing the plutocratic agenda of those elites, the party's popular support has dwindled to a nub that's nutty, focusing on what one Republican leader calls tinfoil hat issues. For example, a top agenda item for today's withered Tea Party is a full-bore howling assault on something that isn't even there, a nefarious United Nations plot to destroy American freedom and establish a UN dictatorship over us. Yes, the same international debating society that the right wing used to mock as meek and weak is presently being recast as a fearsome totalitarian behemoth brazenly stripping our sovereignty from us. The UN's weapon is not some secret army, but a piece of paper. Titled Agenda 21, it's just a series of non-binding UN recommendations to encourage sustainable economic growth in developing nations through voluntary actions. It's an innocuous document with zero force behind it, passed way back in 1992 with the support of Republican President George Bush. Some threat. But in recent months, Agenda 21 was turned into a foaming-at-the-mouth cause by the nattering nabob of nuttiness, Glenn Beck. So Beck's disciples have been waving the tattered Tea Party banner and rushing to the barricades to, by God, defend America from this piece of paper. This is Jim Hightower saying, the wonder is that even 8% of the public has stuck with the Tea Party.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point. I mean, the Republicans would be going nuts.
They'd be doing something. They'd be going ape, terrestrial. They'd be going ape nuts, if you want to put it that way. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So the president said our journey's not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote. So what are we going to do about that? The right will have you say, well, what we'll do is we'll just exclude you from voting. We'll take you off the roll. We'll make it, you know, very impossible for you to get the ID that you, that we're going to ram down your throat. I always found it, I still find it amazing, that the same Republicans, because I've got a couple of friends who were, when I was screaming about a national ID card and what a bad idea I thought it was under the Real ID Act, who were going, yeah, we shouldn't have to have, they shouldn't mandate me to, I shouldn't have to do anything. I should have no responsibility and all of this, and really very angry about it, especially when you tell them there's an RFID chip inside and tracking and all that stuff. They were outraged that they would have to have this card. But now when they think, well, we're going to stop those black people from voting, or those poor people, or those old people, or those college students, if we're going to stop them from voting, they seem to be all in favor of it now. All because their team would win. And again, it's not even their team that would win. It's the handful that would win. And what's frustrating to me is we've bought into this. The people want divided government. We've bought into, you know, people wanted the Republicans to control the House of Representatives, which is nonsense. What happened is they gerrymandered. Well, they had control of a number of state legislatures who, you know, did some creative mapping. And now you look at Virginia, who is doing the gerrymandering right before our very eyes. In fact, they have, yesterday, while the inauguration was going on, The state Senate in Virginia rushed through a bill to redistrict the state's Senate seats. And in fact, they redistricted it in such a way where they would a Democrat would lose his seat. You know, that's the gerrymandering. The vote was 20 to 19. It would have been a tie. It would have been 20 to 20. Had one of the Democrats, a guy named Harry Marsh, had he not gone to the inauguration. Now, Marsh was a civil rights leader, back during the, during the 60s. And, here's the thing that gets me. I guess the question is, did he do it knowing he was going to be away? And did they ram it through while, we got an opportunity. Let's go, go, go. And what kind of backroom deal is that? What kind of backdoor way of governing is that? And the reality is it's what Republicans do. They cheat. It's simple. And look, if the Democrats were doing this, I would be saying the exact same thing. There's a right way and a wrong way to do things. And you look at what's going on here in Pennsylvania with a lot of the stuff, this lottery thing, there can be no one to look at that and say that was done the right way. And you look at House Bill 94, where the only reason that they're proposing House Bill 94 to change how this state for, 220, 230 years has allocated the electors to elect the President of the United States, now they want to change it. Why? Well, because our guy can win. Not that they're going to run a candidate who could win. No. We want the radicals. We want what the business community says is acceptable. And we're going to see that across the country, trust me. That whole scheme that they've come up with. Personally, I'm a fan of popular vote. It is what it is. The guy who gets the most votes wins. I believe that every candidate who wins office should have 50% of the vote plus one, which is why I've always been a fan of instant runoff voting, so that you have a candidate with majority vote. It's simple to me, but probably never going to happen. I mean, there are some states that have it. A lot of localities have it, states, where, if you don't get 50%, you have the runoff. This way it encourages third, fourth, fifth candidates. It encourages people to get into the public sphere to push ideas and issues and to hold people accountable. But I guess we're not going to see that. All we're going to see, I think, is more of this divisiveness. And I'm hoping, and as I've said before, I'm hoping that this second term, I'm hoping that hope returns. I'm hoping that the leadership that I'm told he is showing will pop up. I'm hoping that there will be direction and the steely spine will be there that I'm told. I'm just skeptical, and I have been for some time, because all I've seen happen over the last 4 years is us bailing out these big corporations and Wall Street and the wealth class and making sure that that the top is well healed, while demagoguing and demeaning and demoralizing and pointing fingers at the people on the bottom, the ones who have struggled and sacrificed. I love that rhetoric. We need to sacrifice. I'm not seeing any sacrifice from the very wealthy. What I'm seeing, I'm seeing people doing really well. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Earth, sky,
On January 8, 2013, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Climatic Data Center released the latest climate report for the year 2012.
It confirmed that 2012 was the warmest year ever recorded in the contiguous United States. The average temperature for the U.S. was 3.2 degrees Fahrenheit above 20th century average. 2012 beat 1998 as the warmest year ever recorded in the U.S. In general, 2012 brought the U.S. its fourth warmest winter, warmest spring ever recorded, second warmest summer, and a warmer than average fall.
We have a list of the extreme weather events that occurred in 2012 across the contiguous U.S. at our website, earthsky.org. Here are a few examples.
There have now been 9 consecutive 12-month periods that make up the 9 warmest such periods in the CONUS record. That's a record of soil characteristics, including temperature.
356 all-time record high maximum temperatures were known to be tied or broken in the U.S. in 2012.
Nearly 100 million people, about a third of the U.S. population, experienced 10 or more days of temperatures that reached or exceeded 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Plus, 8 of the past 10 warmest years ever recorded for the United States have occurred since 1990. We have more at earthsky.org. Search for the words warmest year on record. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org. Earth.
You know, if the Democrats said we had a war on caterpillars, then every mainstream media outlet talked about the fact that Republicans have a war on caterpillars, then we'd have problems with caterpillars. I mean, the fact of the matter is it's a fiction.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
Ah, yes, we could have corporate rule. Oh, that would be fabulous. If, you know, the handful could rule, you know, like the brethren of the past, the robber barons of the past, with an iron fist and absolute power. I still think about the one guy I met years ago who said that, you know, back in the early 70s when he came back from Vietnam, he had saved a little bit of money. And for the first time in his family's history in this country, when he went home and paid his father's debt to the company store, he was not in debt. The family was not in debt to the company. I mean, that just blows my mind. And you think about it. You know, like I said last week, you know, Obama's campaign slogan was forward. Linda Thompson, you know, her screwed up campaign is onward. I think Corbett should be backward because that's exactly where they're taking us. Anyway, today is the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. You know, across the country, there have been 135 new state level restrictions on abortion. And, you know, and that's just over the past 2 years. This assault on women's rights, this assault on their bodies, to me is just, well, it's ideologically driven. And as I've been saying, it's not just about Roe. It's about Griswold as well, which is why I've asked Andy Hoover, legislative director of the Pennsylvania ACLU, to come talk to us on the anniversary. Andy, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, you're welcome. It's nice to talk to you.
So I look at this legislatively, 135 new restrictions. You know, the 50 states over the last 2 years, I mean, there's a ton of money in this.
Yes. That is a lot of restrictions in a very short period of time. And with the changes in state legislatures and governor's offices after the 2010 election, we saw a situation where those who had power felt they had the opportunity to attack women's rights, and that's the situation we're in today.
You know what I wish? I wish they would take that kind of, that kind of eagerness, that kind of stick-to-itiveness, that kind of, initiative and create jobs.
Yeah, well, it's much easier to, roll back, access to reproductive health care, I guess, when you have that kind of power. But I do think that, you know, Rick, the pendulum certainly has the opportunity to swing back. You know, we saw that in the 2012 election, where those who spoke out against women's rights and reproductive health care got smacked. You know, talking about rape during a campaign is not a wise electoral strategy, as we found out in Indiana and Missouri.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, those were two seats that the Democrats were most certainly going to lose, other than for their radical views, the Republicans' radical views on those issues.
Right, exactly. And a couple of well, actually one for each of those Republican candidates in the states. They both made one comment each about abortion and rape, and there was a backlash. And we're seeing now that Americans definitely are moving more in the category of supporting comprehensive reproductive health care. There's a Pew poll that just came out in the last day or so showing that today 70% of Americans believe that Roe versus Wade should not be overturned. And that's the highest it's ever been since Pew started tracking that number. So we are definitely on the upswing.
Yeah, but I mean, here at the end of this, you know, and look, personally, I'm not in favor of abortion, for me personally. But I don't think I should have the right to tell Andy Hoover and his wife or anybody else and their wife or any woman what they do with their body. It's not my position. And what bothers me is, you know, what we had, and you look at what happened in Washington where you had all men talking about contraception, not a woman on the panel. To me, it just seems like one of these pointing down your nose at someone kind of dictates.
Yeah, it absolutely is. This is not just about abortion. And one of our allies, the Women's Law Project, had an op-ed that appeared in a few newspapers today around the state, and their executive director, Carol Tracy, made a good point. You know, if this was just about abortion, they wouldn't be so hung up about contraception. But their hang-ups around contraception show that this is really about controlling women and controlling their bodies and using government power to do that.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the thing is, I've been talking about this for 8 years now. Because you saw this coming. This is who the Republican Party is. So it surprises me that there are still women who are on board with this party.
Well, you know, Rick, as the ACLU, you know, we are a civil libertarian organization, and our feeling is that there are many situations in which the government should just not be involved.
Yep.
And one of those is women's reproductive health care. And in this case, you would think that would be a natural position for Republicans who supposedly believe in limited government. Back off, stay out of the bedroom, but too many of them, unfortunately, choose not to do that.
I mean, for me, the real, like I said earlier, I'm not in favor of it. I am in favor of it being safe and legal, because I go back to my childhood. My mother, you know, told me the story, you know, back when this had just passed. You know, when she was back in school back in the 60s, she had a friend who went to Kentucky, had one of these backroom abortions, and ended up dying from it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think of that and I go, do I want my daughters to be in that situation where now they're criminals?
Right.
And
exactly.
The answer is no.
Right. Exactly.
But I want to make sure that they're able to keep themselves safe with education, with access to contraception. So I just find it, if you're against abortion and you're against that, why would you be against contraception? Why would you be pushing this ignorant, abstinence-only nonsense that we know doesn't work?
Right. In the years, the 15 years after Roe, delivery rates did not go down. There were some anti-abortion folks who thought that it would, because you'd have more access to abortion. But what did go down was maternal mortality. Women were not dying as a result of their pregnancies. There's a very good film that we just recently relaunched. It's 20 years old, but it's excellent. It's called Motherless. You can watch it online at watchmotherless.org. And it's about four people whose mothers died from illegal abortions. You know, I was born 6 months after Roe, and so I didn't live through that. I didn't know what that was about. But watching that film and understanding, getting an understanding of what it was like for women before Roe is really important. I think a lot of people should check that out.
Yeah, which, you know, I go back to this whole campaign of the last 2 years and this push against not just abortion, but the control of a woman in her body. It just blows my mind that I still see women supporting some of these people.
Yes, I wish I could explain that.
it's beyond the thought process. I struggle with it. With this being the anniversary, you know, and going back and thinking about that, it brings back that vivid memory I had with my mother those years ago, and thinking, boy, I never want that for my kids.
Yes, and we don't want to go back there. And, you know, people point to that clinic in Philadelphia that was not being inspected properly, as the Department of Health should have been. But we would have more of that if we restrict women's access to abortion. And I'm concerned that we, you know, there are, even with the, I said we're on the upswing, but I want to be sure that we don't have any more laws that further restrict.
So let me ask you about the healthcare exchange that's coming up. A lot of states, I think something like 20 states here in the U.S. have been given, they're not going to allow insurers to cover women through the Affordable Care Act. Explain that to me.
Sure. The Affordable Care Act, the idea was states would implement the insurance exchanges, and that, of course, gave the states power to regulate what happens in the exchanges. Pennsylvania opted out, but they still have the ability under federal law to pass a state law to ban insurance companies from covering abortion care in the exchanges. So if you're someone who, say, you don't make enough money and, to buy your own insurance and you need to buy it through the exchange, you're self-employed, you don't have employer benefits, and you buy insurance through the exchange, you would not be able to get abortion coverage if this kind of bill passed here in Pennsylvania. It passed both the Senate and the House last session, but did not make it to the governor. The two different bills passed each chamber. So we're hopeful it doesn't come up again this session, but it could.
Yeah, I expect all of that craziness to come up here in the next 6-8 months, before the next election. Get it out of the way early. I expect a lot of the no rights at work agenda to make its way to the light of day.
Yeah, I try to be optimistic, and hopefully, I hope that they got the message that, this is not politically smart, even if you may think, even if the people in power may think this way ideologically. I hope they understand that it's political suicide to go down this road, whether it's this or it's LGBT rights or immigration. I hope the message has been sent that any party that dabbles in those areas and tries to restrict people's rights, they're committing political suicide.
Now, I had thought about that with the privatization scheme last time of the wine and spirit shops. That's back, going to be back, I guess. The privatization of this lottery thing, that's up. I mean, you would think after last year they kind of shied away, but I see them putting the foot on the gas and going full tilt boogie forward.
It may be. On the insurance exchange, we figure if it's going to happen, it will happen, like you said, the first 6 to 8 months, because the exchanges are supposed to be up and online by October. So they have to do it soon if they're going to do it.
Yeah, I was happy to hear Corbett say he wasn't going to do it. He's going to leave it up to the feds, because I think we'll get a better deal that way.
That could be. Unfortunately, we still have to deal with this abortion issue because the state legislature could still regulate it.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that, worries me. Andy, I appreciate the time. Thanks for talking to us.
Okay, thanks, Rick. I'll see you later.
As I said earlier, one of the things that worries me, as someone who has two daughters, what's the future look like? I hope it's not back where we've come from. And I guess it's easy to go, that stuff couldn't happen. Because we've not really learned our history. We've learned what the wealth class wants us to know. Regurgitate a couple of dates. That kind of stuff. Quick break, back with hour two.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As the nation honored Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy on Monday, the labor movement and the civil rights movement commemorated the solidarity that they share in the struggle for justice. In Memphis, during the sanitation workers' strike, just before an assassin's bullet struck him down, Dr. King talked about dignity for workers in Memphis and in the United States.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor.
In 1968, Dr. King told
CIU 1199 members that he walked many picket lines for justice for workers. He said solidarity and struggle is what will win social and economic justice for workers.
Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. We are going to demand what is ours. And my friends, the resources are here in America. The question is whether the will is here. If we will stand and work together, we will bring into being that day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
At Wisconsin's commemoration of Dr. King, the widow of the late former father James Groppi criticized Governor Scott Walker for his attack on unions as she accepted an award for her late husband. Margaret Rozga spoke as the governor sat nearby.
As the widow of a man who, after we married, not only drove bus but became the president of Local 998 Amalgamated Transit Union, as a person who remembers that Martin Luther King was killed while he was working to organize sanitation workers, I know that anyone who works to curtail union rights is not in the tradition of Martin Luther King.
Coca-Cola workers in Germany are spilling out of their plants and onto picket lines to protest flexible working hours. Jesse Russell reports.
Flexible working hours and better wages have Coca-Cola employees walking the picket lines all across Germany. The workers are engaging in a series of warning strikes in advance of continued contract negotiations with the company. The strikes are taking place at the 50 Coca-Cola bottling plants throughout Germany. The union has called the strikes in protest of the threat of staff reductions and the introduction of flexible working hours, which could include mandatory weekend shifts. Negotiations are set to continue on January 30th, but so far there's been little sign of movement from the company. The workers are represented by the Beverages and Catering Industry Trade Union, which has argued that the plant workers have sacrificed by going years without wage increases.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that if the full range of tax increases and spending cuts were allowed to take effect, a scenario widely referred to as the fiscal cliff, a shallow recession would occur early next year.
Just come around. That's all you are to me.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So yesterday, something like 2 million people out in the streets. And like I said in one of the interviews I had the opportunity to do yesterday, I said, look, you know, you got 2 million people out in the streets today saying that we want the realization of the dream. We want social economic justice. We want people to have opportunity. We want that ladder to the middle class, to opportunity, to a better life for ourselves and our kids and future generations, all of that. We want that vision, that dream, if you will. Has it been realized? Not with the high school dropout rates that we see in a lot of places, not with the graduation rates, not with the division that we have. Inequality at the worst point that it's been in 100 years. So how do we get there? Is there a possibility for a better tomorrow? And were you encouraged by what you saw yesterday out of the president? Not so much here, which is why I've asked Professor Richard Wolff to come talk to us about his thoughts, what the alternatives are, and can we have that progressive vision for a better tomorrow? Professor Wolff, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me, Rick.
You know, what were your thoughts of yesterday's inaugural address?
Well, they were the same as they've been most of last year. That is, comparing Mr. Obama to what the Republicans would have given us, you know, you can only be grateful that you have Mr. Obama, and I don't take that away from him. But compared to the problems we have and what needs to be done, I'm just as equally disappointed by what I see as a refusal to face the economic realities that are bearing down on the American people, and the sense I have that just as Martin Luther King said, if the people themselves don't organize and mobilize and make change, they're going to keep getting the short end of the stick.
Yeah, which is why I've said I'm encouraged by the fact that in New York you saw fast food workers in the streets striking. In Chicago you saw restaurant workers striking. Our Walmart people throughout the country, you saw that, the Chicago teachers taking to the streets. There's a sense that there's enough. People have had enough already. As the saying goes, there's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat. And I think we're almost at that point.
Yes, I think so, too. And for me, the shenanigans around the fiscal cliff, these theatrics hyped in the media in which we're supposed to get excited by the Democrats and the Republicans bickering over the details of a program that is the worst possible thing to do in an economic crisis. This combination of rising taxes, which is what they just did, coupled to government spending cuts, which they're what they're about to do, and I'm referring to both parties here, is something that should make every American working person very, very angry. We have been now through 5 years of an economic crisis that working people didn't cause but have had to endure. We've watched a government program of bailouts go overwhelmingly to the biggest banks and corporations to bring recovery to the stock market, but to bypass the mass of the American people, and to have that kind of a 1-2 punch followed by a program of raising our taxes and cutting government programs just when we need them most, you're absolutely right. It is way beyond too much, and all we can hope and pray for is that people finally realize that if we don't mobilize, we're looking at a long period of economic decline.
Well, because there are some people who've said, they point to Japan, they had the lost decade. There are some people who said, we've already had our lost decade, and now we're working on number two.
Absolutely, and the Japanese are a signpost to us. Their depression or recession, whatever you want to call it, begins in 1989, 1990. So by that count, we're talking 22 years during which the Japanese economy, which was once a competitor of the United States, rushing up to gain on us, has been in the doldrums now for better than two decades with no end in sight. It should long ago have been a cautionary tale for the United States, showing us that we need to take bold steps rather than carry out old line programs like an austerity in the middle of a crisis. So I am, as many of my economics colleagues are, very, very worried by the flow, by the direction of what is being done in the United States, unfortunately, by both parties.
Right. You said a second ago that one of the worst things you can do is raise taxes. And I guess my question is to qualify who we're talking about. Because, is it the payroll tax or is it the tax on the very wealthy? Because personally, I'm of the mindset we should be talking about raising taxes on the very wealthy, if not back to the Reagan years or the Kennedy years, maybe even the Eisenhower years.
Absolutely. I mean, the truth of it is that any serious reference to what we just saw at the end of 2012 as being a serious program of taxing the rich is, and I'm trying to be polite here, inaccurate. That's not what we just did. The rate of the income tax went on the richest people went from 35% to 39.6%. That changes fundamentally nothing. That doesn't make a rich person significantly less rich than he was before, even if he pays all of it, which most of them won't do. The real big tax increase was the increase in the payroll tax from 4.2% to 6.2% out of every working person's check. The real victims of this tax are not only the American people who have to pay it, but all of the Americans who will lose their jobs because the mass of Americans don't have that money to spend on goods and services because they're giving it to the government. Now, it might have been all right if the government turned around and spent all that money, but the government has assured us that they're about to cut government spending. So, yeah, absolutely, this is a tax increase that is economically senseless and socially unjust given the circumstances. The last thing to say, your point, we should, of course, tax rich people. The economic logic of that, which is taught in every university course in economics that I'm aware of, the economics of that goes as follows. Rich people, when you tax them, overwhelmingly use their wealth, their savings accumulated to pay the extra taxes. They do not significantly reduce their high-off-the-hog lifestyles. So when you tax rich people, you do not suffer the economic consequences of less spending, which is what you do suffer when you raise taxes on middle and lower income people. And that's one of the reasons why the argument of going back to the tax rates on rich people that we had in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s makes so much sense. And it would raise huge sums of money that, for those who care about the deficit, would reduce our deficit. Let's remind your listeners, in case they don't remember, the top income tax rate in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s went between 91 and 71% compared to the 35% it's been in the last few years. And we should remember that both Republican and Democratic presidents and Congresses endorsed those high rates. And it might be useful to remember why we taxed wealthy people that much. We had just come out of the Great Depression of the 1930s. We had just come out of the immediately following World War II. We had to rebuild a pretty badly hammered American economy. And the argument went, everybody ought to pay, quote, unquote, their fair share according to what they were capable of. And Republicans and Democrats agreed that that meant rich people should pay 91% the top rate, and corporations should pay much more than they are doing now. If that logic applied to the crisis America was going through then, pray tell, explain to me why a similar logic wouldn't apply to the country we are facing now in one of the worst crises since that time. And it's shocking and shameful that not only haven't we raised the taxes on the rich, but that neither of our two parties even brings that idea forward as if somehow American history of the not-so-distant past had never happened.
Yeah, I've asked the question a number of times. Why we're just talking about going back to the Clinton years, why not talk about the other things? And to me, it's economic malpractice. If you look at the fact that we did something that Bush himself couldn't do, we made the Bush rates permanent.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is truly and to think that raising the upper income tax rate from 35% to 39.6% qualifies in the context of American history as a tax on the rich. If I were a rich person, I'd be laughing all the way to the bank. This got me off the hook. I could have been looking at serious tax rates of the sort that my father and grandfather before me had to face. And that didn't hamper America's rich from continuing to be rich. And yet I got away with literally tax murder in this situation, because the big crisis of America ended up as a whimper because it didn't bother me in any significant way as a very, very wealthy person. And if you add to that the overwhelming statistics of the last 5, 10, 25 years in which the rich have gotten markedly richer, that is, markedly more able to carry a significant load of a country in crisis, we're doing a very strangely unpatriotic thing. We are saying to those most able to pay, those who have done the best in the last 30 years, those who are more responsible for bringing this crisis than other people, and those who've gotten the bulk of the bailouts since this crisis hit, given all those advantages, we still don't want to tax them even as much as they did 30 and 40 years ago to help the country out. What kind of a society does that? Strikes me as bizarre.
I'm right there with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Professor Richard Wolff talking about the bailout and all the things economic. You know, one of the things that got me is you look at this, again, what they've done is what the wealth class in this country and what the wealth class throughout history have always been able to do is pit we and the working class against one another. And I always point to the Jay Gould quote, the railroad magnate from the 1880s, who said, "I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half." What we see, though, is them pitting us against each other. Well, you know, they're going to raise my taxes and not yours. It's the others and all of this stuff. But you're seeing it on a worldwide basis. We keep being told that, you know, we pay the highest taxes of anywhere in the world. Is that actually accurate?
No, it's never been accurate. It's a game. There's two kinds of things you always have to remember. There's the official tax rate, that is the technical percentage of profits that a business enterprise is required to pay. But just as important, and often even more important, are all of the exemptions and exceptions that apply, that corporations can use to make their actual tax rate different from the official rate. So, for example, here in the United States, the official rate is 35%. But when you figure out the average benefits of exemptions and exceptions that corporations can and do regularly appeal to, you get a rate much closer to 22, 21, 23%. It varies from corporation to corporation. The official rate in other countries is a little lower than the United States in many cases. But, correspondingly, their exceptions and exemptions are also lower. So when it all works out, the United States doesn't have a significantly different effective tax rate, that's what it's called, on corporations from most other advanced industrial countries. It's just a clever ploy of the business community to focus attention on the official rate and count on people not knowing that very few companies pay the official rate because companies here and abroad take advantage of all kinds of exceptions and exemptions that they are legally entitled to. So it's just a cheap game.
Yeah, you know, I'm told often there's no alternative to what we're doing. The Tina argument that we need the job creators. We need to feed the chair. We need to make sure that everything trickles up because something at some point will spill off onto the floors for you and me and my listeners to fight over. Yet the pockets never seem to get full. Nothing ever seems to trickle out.
Well, you know, the history gives the lie to that kind of an argument. Let me make a simple illustration of that. If you paid attention to what I said a minute ago, if your listeners were listening, they know that the tax rate, the top tax rate on wealthy people in the 50s and 60s was 91%. If I had time, I'd explain that the tax on corporations was much higher then than it is now. So let's look. Did those high taxes on corporations and rich people produce high unemployment the way they claim because somehow job creation was hurt? The answer is exactly the opposite. We had less unemployment in the 50s and 60s than we have today, much less. And we had much greater economic growth in the 50s and 60s than we have today. In other words, high taxes on corporations and the rich were historically associated with a thriving economy and low unemployment, whereas today, as taxes were reduced on corporations and reduced on individuals, we face massive unemployment and very low economic growth. So there simply is no basis, none in economics, for this kind of an argument. It is a wonderful or terrible, if you, depending on your perspective, example of what we used to call the big lie story in history. If you repeat it often enough, you can overwhelm everybody else. So you keep saying, we must cut taxes so that the job creators will create jobs. Well, any real business knows that there are many reasons why you hire more people rather than less people. Taxes is only a small part of it. The big story is, do you believe you can produce more and sell more in the market? If you don't, you don't hire people, whether your taxes are high or low.
Yep.
As the reality of American history is, there's no correlation, none, between the level of taxes you impose on wealthy people and corporations on the one hand and the prevalence of job creation on the other. It's just as much reasonable in economics to say that if you want to create jobs, put the maximum income into the hands of middle and lower income people, because being middle and lower income, they take the income they earn and they spend it on goods and services, thereby creating jobs. to give the role of job creator to the rich person is an exercise in economic fantasy, and it shouldn't really be allowed to pass.
I'm right there with you. You know, I think back to my grandfather's generation who, you know, they demanded full employment policies and they demanded a fair share of the wealth that they create. A lot of it through, you know, joining and forming unions and collective bargaining through the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And I'm hoping that, you know, we look back to that time and go, you know, what did they know that we seem to have missed? And I think you've laid some of it out because, you know, my grandfather, you know, fought those, you know, went to World War II, fought the war there, came back, fought the same kind of battle on the shop floor to be part of the middle class. I'm hoping that we see that again.
Yeah, I'm hoping it too. And it seems to me, again, our history ought to be a better guide for us than we allow it to be. In the depths of the Great Depression in the 1930s, let's remember how different things were than they are today. That was a depression worse than what we have today. We had 25% unemployment in 1933 compared to 8% today.
Let me ask you, with that statement, without unemployment, without food stamps, without all the elasticity programs and the social safety net stuff, could we have been at 25 or 30%?
Absolutely. I mean, we're lucky that we have in place enough of the so-called automatic adjustments when this sad economic system we have plunges us into its recurring economic cycles. We're lucky we have them. But what we're lucky because in the 1930s, history was different. We had a terrible depression. But when everybody said then, as they say now, well, there's no money, we can't help people, we can't sustain social programs, we can't do it, the American people said, wait a minute, stop. You have to do it. End of conversation. You're going to do it. We had the biggest labor organizing drive in American history. The CIO, in the middle of the Great Depression, organized millions of workers who had never been in unions before. We had socialist and communist parties. That's right. We had them here in the United States, and they worked with the CIO. And they went to the President, Roosevelt, and they said, hey, we represent millions of people. You've got to do something. We're not going to let you simply bail out the people at the top. We're not going to let you save the stock market. You have to take care of us. And there was the implied or else. And guess what? Roosevelt was a smart politician. He understood who was talking to him and that they meant business. So he went back to the corporations and the rich, and he said to them, I've got to do something for the mass of people, or else the whole kit and caboodle of our economic system is going to go out the window, and you have to pay for it, gentlemen of the corporations. And, you know, he persuaded half of them to do it. The other half became his eternal enemies, but the half that he persuaded gave him enough support that he went back and did what would now seem impossible. He went on the radio and he said to the American people, okay, I'm going to really help you in the depths of this terrible depression. He created the Social Security system. I'm going to give everybody over 65, after a lifetime of real work, a check for the rest of your life, a pension. I'm going to create the unemployment compensation system in the United States. If you lose a job through no fault of your own, I'm going to give you a year or two of weekly checks to help you. And then the most important one, he said, if the private sector cannot or will not provide work, I'm going to provide jobs as a president, federal jobs. And he created and filled 12.5 million jobs from 1934 to 1941. What a stunning situation. Turns out the money was there. And you know where he got it? By raising taxes on corporations and the rich, which is why they were so high in the 50s and 60s. Roosevelt showed not only that you could do that, that you could help people in a depression the way we are not doing today, but he also showed that it can be done by taxing corporations and the rich. Final point. Did that make him a terrible pariah? Did that make people hate him? On the contrary, Roosevelt became the most popular president in the history of the United States. He was reelected 4 consecutive times. No president had ever achieved that before. It so freaked out the Republicans that after Roosevelt died in 1945, they passed a law that prevented any president ever after again from having more than two terms. But that was a testimony to that not only is it possible to get through an economic downturn radically different than we're doing it today, but the people of America will enthusiastically endorse that kind of a politics, which makes it only more mysterious why the leadership today or yesterday is unable, unwilling to take a page from American history and at least do as well as was done before.
Now, I'm right there with you. It blows my mind, and I'm hoping that, not having to run for re-election, maybe we see some of the headlines that I saw today come true, that he's steely spine and, unapologetically progressive and all of these things. I'm hoping it gives him that spine to go forward and do some of the things that I had hoped in the beginning of the last term.
Well, me too, but I tell you, I'll put more of my little betting money on the thing you've opened the program with. Those workers at Walmart, the school teachers in Chicago, the people who were so courageous in Wisconsin a while earlier, that kind of momentum is what made the history of the 1930s so different, and that's what I'm hoping will make a difference now, with or without a change of heart on Mr. Obama and his administration's part. In the end, it's the working people who make that history, and that's what everybody's waiting for.
Yeah, well, it's the people getting out in the streets, as I've been saying for the longest time.
Yep.
Professor Wolf, I appreciate the time. It's always great, and it's always insightful talking to you.
Okay, it's my pleasure as well, and if you'd like to again in the future, just give me a ring.
I most certainly will. Thank you, Professor Wolf. rdwolf.com, the website. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. We've also got a link to a number of his publications. One of my favorite videos on the web is Capitalism Hits the Fan. You definitely want to check that out. But again, highlighting a lot of the things that we've been talking about here on the program for some time. You go back and you think about that greatest generation who, like I said, my grandfather, they fought World War II. They came back and said, you know what? Enough. The Depression's over. We want to be moving forward. We want decent wages. We want decent conditions. We want benefits. We want security. We want these things. And it's there. That's the thing that infuriates me right now is a lot of people have been so, wow, we're broke. We can't do anything. We're broke, which is nonsense. We're going to bankrupt the country. How many times have you heard that? We're going to bankrupt the country. No, we're not. We got rich people who have gotten away with probably the biggest heist in the history of the nation, if you look at 2008. And it blows my mind that we have not seen perp walks, that we have not seen entire wings of prisons set up just for these criminals. Because if it was you or me, where we would be. But here again, and he hit on the most important point. It's you. It's me. It's all of us. It's those 2 million people who came out to see the inauguration going home and saying, you know what? We can't do what we did 4 years ago. Because I truly believe one of the biggest problems is most people who voted for Obama thought, hey, we elected them. The Democrats thought, hey, our work's over. We elected them. They're going to take it from here. Go on. And people went back to their lives. They're wanted. We trust them. They'll take care of it. And they found out quickly that they couldn't. Which is why I think now, a little different. I think now you've got people who are doing that hard work of organizing and getting out into the streets and saying, we want full employment policies. We're not so... you listen to the right, all they talk about is inflation's coming. Well, I haven't seen it yet. Prices have gone up a little bit, but the problem is wages have continued to go down. I want to talk about full employment policies. Get people back to work. Roads, bridges, internet, all of that stuff. A lot of the investment that we haven't been doing for the last 30 years, we need to be doing right now. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Explore exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year. If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
The once haughty Tea Party has been whittled down to only a nub of its former self, with only 8% of Americans now identifying themselves with a faction. And no wonder. The fiery movement that sprang from legitimate anger over the government bailout of Wall Street banksters quickly got co-opted by Republican political operatives fronting for those same banksters and for such corporate extremists as the Koch brothers. By brandishing the plutocratic agenda of those elites, the party's popular support has dwindled to a nub that's nutty, focusing on what one Republican leader calls tinfoil hat issues. For example, a top agenda item for today's withered Tea Party is a full-bore howling assault on something that isn't even there, a nefarious United Nations plot to destroy American freedom and establish a UN dictatorship over us. Yes, the same international debating society that the right wing used to mock as meek and weak is presently being recast as a fearsome totalitarian behemoth brazenly stripping our sovereignty from us. The UN's weapon is not some secret army, but a piece of paper. Titled Agenda 21, it's just a series of non-binding UN recommendations to encourage sustainable economic growth in developing nations through voluntary actions. It's an innocuous document with zero force behind it, passed way back in 1992 with the support of Republican President George Bush. Some threat. But in recent months, Agenda 21 was turned into a foaming-at-the-mouth cause by the nattering nabob of nuttiness, Glenn Beck. So Beck's disciples have been waving the tattered Tea Party banner and rushing to the barricades to, by God, defend America from this piece of paper. This is Jim Hightower saying, the wonder is that even 8% of the public has stuck with the Tea Party.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hey, pretty baby, don't you hear the drummer thumping? You gotta shake it like a crazy. Cause the band is saying something. Everybody is a jumping. You gotta slap, pop, flip, flop, and pop all around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Bob sent me an email during the break, said that I'm too hard on the president, says that it's the GOP and Congress. It's their fault they're holding the nation hostage and that we have to do something about the filibuster. And look, I'm right there with you. At the end of the day, I want to know who it is who's holding things up. I want to know who's holding the nation hostage. None of this secret holds, but more importantly, I want them to go to the floor and make their case. Everyone's seen the movie. They've seen Mr. Smith. I want to see it. If you got a problem with it, I want you on the floor making your case. And stay on topic. None of this nonsense reading Moby Dick or the phone book. Actually have the debate. The question is, what are we going to do with the filibuster reform? Will Harry Reid actually do something? Or will he cave on that as well? Which is why I've asked David Waldman, host of the Daily Kozes radio program, to come talk to us. David, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
I am good. You know, I look at this, and you know, I think like most people, at least most people I've talked to, I don't know what your experience is, believe that, you know what, if you want to filibuster, if you want to, you want to hold things up, you want to delay, install, and gridlock, you should have to take to the floor and make your case.
Yeah, I think most people do think that that's the way it ought to work. And, you know, the advantage of offering a reform plan that does that, that would try and force that to happen, is even people who are worried about the filibuster being an essential tool, this would just bring it back to what the way they thought it worked in the first place. So it makes it pretty attractive.
And that's a big point to make. The way most of us thought it was. Most people I talk to go, isn't that how it works? They're surprised when they find out that someone can just put a hold on it and you not even know who it is. It just stops.
Yeah. Well, they tried to take a stab at getting rid of the secret hold, but they found out that the truth is that the secret hold, all holds, are rooted in the filibuster. The only thing you can do, as long as the filibuster is sort of still hanging around, is make it a practice that, out of courtesy, everyone should be expected to tell everyone else who's holding what. Well, they don't really have to do it, so they don't do it. It doesn't work out that way.
So what's the answer here? I mean, there are some who are saying that Harry Reid should pursue the quote-unquote nuclear option. There are some folks I've talked to said, you know, 51 votes should be enough. Cloture was never really a part of it. Where do you see this going?
Well, I don't see any really huge change coming. I think that everybody who's actually talking about making some kind of change is still talking about retaining the ability to filibuster. The main thing that people who want any sort of change agree on is to cut down on the number. And the way they'll try and do that is get rid of opportunities during the normal legislative process that you can filibuster at, these choke points in the process. So they'll keep the ability to say, hey, if you really have a serious problem with a bill or a nomination or any measure that's moving through the Senate, you'll have your opportunity to stand up and be counted and show everybody that you oppose this thing and slow it down, and the weight of the Senate will have to be brought to bear against you if they want to beat you on this thing. They're just going to try and cut it down to one or two bites at this apple instead of six or seven on every bill's way through the Senate.
And well, do you think that will hold down the number? Because the numbers, I saw a chart the other day, the number of filibusters in the last legislative session through the roof.
Yeah. Well, that by itself won't necessarily hold down the numbers. I mean, a single bill doesn't tend to get filibustered in that many places. In the last session or so, you've seen things like a filibuster just to begin debate on something and then a filibuster to end debate on something. And we'll probably still see something close to that for really controversial bills. But one of the things that can cut down on the number is if they actually make filibustering cost senators time and cause them pain, essentially, to conduct one. And that's one of the reasons why you see people saying they want to go back to this talking filibuster. If senators have to actually take time out of their day and waste time that they are otherwise wasting raising money, meeting with constituents, which is not a waste of time, but meeting at committee meetings and doing all the things that senators pack into a busy day, if they have to spend that time on the floor, that really costs them. And that will be, that's hoped anyway, will be what cuts down on the number. If you're not truly committed to stopping a bill, but you're just doing it because a buddy of yours on the same side of the aisle has asked you to provide a vote, that's one thing. If it's going to cost you all day and maybe all week, we're hoping that'll cut down on the number there, and they'll save it for the things that they really believe in, which would be okay.
Yeah, I'm not against the idea of a filibuster because, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, I know at some point the Republicans will be in the majority and the Democrats are going to be in the minority, and there are going to be some ugly things coming down the road that you're going to want to stop. But I'm of the mindset that I want to know why. I think the American people need to see that debate. With the media structure we've got, C-SPAN, all of this stuff, we should be able to see what the arguments are instead of just backroom dealing. And I think a lot of people have a problem with all of the backroom hush-hush secret things that we're not seeing.
Yeah, well, that's always true, and it'll always be the case. I mean, there's not too much we can do to force our way into every room, but it's certainly the case that people want to see, hey, who's against this, and put your name to it. One of the shortfalls of, well, any kind of reform that they try is you can't force people to talk about what you want them to talk about. You can force them to talk, But they may, in fact, still be able to come and, you know, read Moby Dick or do what they do. But at the very least, people will see that and they'll say, hey, this ain't debate. This is baloney. And they'll know who's doing it.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this, because, you know, part of me goes, you know, all of this filibustering, all of this gridlock, all of this delay and all of these hostage crises play right into the Republican meme of the government's broken and government doesn't work and government's ineffective and inefficient and all of those other lines that they use. So when they get into a position where they can make things look worse, they see it doesn't work.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Although, you know, the flip side, I guess, of that is you say you've spent your career telling everybody that government can't work and that it's inefficient, and then you're asked to get up and explain yourself and why do you oppose a certain bill, and all you can do is find a phone book and read it and say, I think I've just discovered what's making this government so inefficient. It's you.
So here again, you know, why don't we exercise our ability to enact term limits and vote the bums out?
Yeah. Well, we run into all kinds of problems when it comes to, well, anytime you find something that might actually turn things over and take the power away from the people who've got it at the moment, you'll find a million reasons why it doesn't work. Term limits, you know, we had our shot at that and we ran into all sorts of issues there.
Well, I'm not in favor of term limits. I think we've already got them.
Yeah. Well, you get a chance to throw people out in the Senate every 6 years and in the House every 2 years, and you got to try and exercise it. This will at least give people something to look at and say, I can see what my representatives and senators have done or have not done in the last couple of years and make a decision based on that. Every local news outlet will have video. If somebody wants to spend 6 hours on the floor reading the phone book or Moby Dick, you'll see it about it on the local news.
And that's why I'm in favor of it.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's... To me, that's important, and I think part of this would then push people back. Okay, if we do this, this is the consequence. We should then come together and figure out how, in the past, things got done. In the future, we should be doing the same.
Yeah, I think so. This, at the very least, this gives people a lot more information to go on, and you know, you might not get a genuine debate about what people really think about any bill that's being considered, but at least you'll be able to tell who's paying attention and has a real opinion on it and who's just playing around.
Playing the game. And that's, I think, what frustrates people because, you know, I truly believe that there's a lot of things that need to be done, and it's not getting done because we've allowed things to gridlock and the things to jam up.
Yeah. Well, we will see how this can come out. As it happens, Harry Reid sounds like he was backing away from requiring the talking filibuster, which disappointed a lot of people. But in the last 24 hours or so, he's hinted at some other changes which could be just as powerful. It would make it doesn't substitute quite the same way and show us, you know, who's serious and who's playing a game, but it might raise the cost or at least transfer the burden of keeping one of these filibusters going to the people who say they want it to keep going. Right now, the way things work, all the people who say, hey, I'd like to get it to a vote, they're the ones who have to do all the work in keeping the Senate running and showing up for all the crazy quorum calls, et cetera. And if you're filibustering, you can just keep one person around to try and block things. Harry Reid's got a plan that's taking shape, and we'll see how people react to it in the next couple of days as he explains it. That'll shift that over to the side that says we got to keep debating, and they are the ones that are going to have to hang around and provide the votes and be on hand as this stuff goes on, and that's the way it should be. If you vote for extending debate, well, go for it. Have a debate, but you got to show up and have it.
Yeah, break out the cots, break out the water jugs, do what you got to do. That's what I'm in favor of. Let me ask you a last question I've got for you. And I don't know if you paid attention to the big inauguration. I'm trying to get as many thoughts and opinions on the president's speeches as possible. What did you think of yesterday's inaugural address?
Well, I was really kind of interested in the way I know the big news that I saw from it, that I saw people talking about, was in addition to the broad and sweeping themes of change and how we were going to do things from this point forward, and I guess a little bit of complaining from Republicans that there wasn't enough somehow outreach to them, which, you know, I don't think that's ever really been what inaugural addresses are about. But I was most struck by the kind of casual way he got around to the theme of equality for LGBT community and just sort of not making a big deal of it and just matter-of-factly saying, hey, you know, we're for equality in this country and that's the way it's going to be going forward and that's the end of the issue. Now let's move on to some other stuff. And that really struck me because it was so meaningful for a lot of people, but handled in such a matter-of-fact way, it feels like the debate's closing.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say that Beyonce lip-synced, but, you know.
That seems to be capturing the most attention, too. But, you know, I got to tell you, I don't think it surprised too many people. And talk about the thing that mattered least.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is what our media focuses on, isn't it not?
Yeah. Well, typically true. And I guess she, in most cases, you could say she was almost the most famous person there. But as it happens, the president was around, too.
Yeah. You know, but, you know, you think about it, you know, and talking about what you just said about the inequality and all that. So could you make the argument that the dream has been realized? Because I talked to a number of people while I was there who told me, well, you know, the king's dream has been realized. And even with all of the inequality that we have in socioeconomically, all of the problems that we have, you know, people there thought, yeah, the dream's been realized. I'm curious your thought.
Well, you know, there's always going to be bumps in the road, and I don't think that Dr. King was in the dark about that either. And nor was the dream necessarily a description of some future paradise. So, I mean, the argument is there to be made that, you know, we're arriving at least at that point in history where, yeah, you can, in fact, judge people by the content of their character and not any of the other factors that have stood in the way for people for a long time. Now, there are still people who are going to insist on holding those kind of retrograde opinions, but, you know, like I said, it wasn't a rose garden here that was promised, not a fantasy land, just the opportunity. That's presenting itself. There's a pretty good argument that if the dream is not secure forever, it is becoming realized more so than ever before.
All right, good thought. David Waldman, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Host of the Daily Kos radio program. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Sky. On January 8, 2013, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Climatic Data Center released the latest climate report for the year 2012.
It confirmed that 2012 was the warmest year ever recorded in the contiguous United States. The average temperature for the U.S. was 3.2 degrees Fahrenheit above 20th century average. 2012 beat 1998 as the warmest year ever recorded in the U.S. In general, 2012 brought the U.S. its fourth warmest winter, warmest spring ever recorded, second warmest summer, and a warmer-than-average fall.
We have a list of the extreme weather events that occurred in 2012 across the contiguous U.S. at our website, earthsky.org. Here are a few examples.
There have now been 9 consecutive 12-month periods that make up the 9 warmest such periods in the CONUS record. That's a record of soil characteristics, including temperature.
356 all-time record high maximum temperatures were known to be tied or broken in the U.S. in 2012.
Nearly 100 million people, about a third of the U.S. population, experienced 10 or more days of temperatures that reached or exceeded 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Plus, 8 of the past 10 warmest years ever recorded for the United States in 1990. We have more at earthsky.org. Search for the words warmest year on record. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Andy sent me an email during the break. He said the transaction tax getting some transaction across the globe. 11 countries signing up to introduce the tax. He says nice 0.1% levy on every transaction except for derivatives at 0.01%. He said my native folks in Slovakia are even going for it. Bucking the checks, sticking with Timmy Geithner and Wall Street criminals, now Jack Lew representing the criminal element of the world. And he's pointing out that, you know, a number of countries, these 11, are now going to have this transaction tax that we've talked about for some time, that says, look, you know, hey, every time you trade a stock, we're going to tax you on it. And we're going to use that money, roads and bridges, putting people to work, oversight. Helping out the economy, getting money from who? Oh, yeah, the people who caused the mess. You know, there's a serious problem. You've created a situation where we're in trouble. And yet not one of these criminals have I seen locked up. And I saw this article in the Sun Gazette that pointed out that there was a guy who had robbed a bank, and actually robbed two of them, that he was sentenced to 10 years in prison today, for robbing this bank in Jersey Shore, Pennsylvania, and one in Altoona. Both of these incidents happened in 2007. 10 years in prison. He waited 5 years in various county prisons for sentencing. And you look at this and you go, guy robs a bank. What did he get out of the bank? $100, $500, $1,000, maybe? 10 years. And yet, the people who crashed our economy, scot-free. And we're not even considering taxing them. I mean, this thing, you know, like I talked about with Professor Wolf, I mean, the reality is the wealth class got what George Bush and the Republicans couldn't give them, permanent certainty. They got the certainty of not having to pay taxes, not having to pay this high rate. And what you've got now, you look at the fact that I just saw this story about Phil Mickelson, the golfer, who was being interviewed by CBS Sports and said, well, you know, hey, I'm going to have to do something because I'm going to have to make drastic changes. Me and my $46 million, my net worth of $150 million, you know, doing all those commercials for arthritis drugs and all the commercials for all the logos, all the apparel that he wears and the golf clubs that he plays with and all of that stuff. What did he make? What was it, $43 million or something? Well, he's complaining because, you know, he says, you know, going to have to do something. This is not a California. He said, you know, there's going to be drastic changes for me because I happen to be in that zone that's been targeted both federally and by the state. And, you know, it doesn't work for me right now. He says, if you add it up all the federal and all the, you know, the disability, unemployment, Social Security, state, all that, he says, my tax rate is 63%. Which, me, I said, wow, that's probably right about where it should be. Because it's that village mentality. Now, I'm sorry, the bigger your shoulders are, the more water you carry. It goes back to the beginning of the caveman. Women pick berries, men go out with the heavy sticks and carry the heavy stuff around. It's that simple. The stronger, the bigger, stronger, carry the more water, do the more work. It's just the reality. But I look at this and he goes, wow, 63%. I'm going, but that seems a bit high. Because on the federal level, what are you talking about? What, 30, 39.6, I think it is now, right? and you throw in all of those loopholes and throw in all of those deductions and all of that stuff, and you go, oh, wait a second, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't add up. I mean, there are numerous ways. And I saw a story that said, you know, really at the top of it, the most he's probably going to pay is somewhere in the 50 range, even with a bad accountant. So maybe he needs to find a decent accountant, because the way I saw this Forbes magazine article pointed out, he said, well, you know, at most, you're looking at 52%. At most. And if, honestly, if he is paying 63%, he should probably fire his accountant. Because there are plenty of loopholes. But the question becomes, you know, I'm sorry that you're going to have to pay a little bit more of your $43 million. But we've got roads that are crumbling. We've got an education system that's being destroyed. We've got public safety programs that need help. We got poverty programs that are underfunded and are being slashed. We've got children's programs that are underfunded and being slashed. And, oh, by the way, we're broke. We don't have any money. Isn't that what they tell us? We've got huge deficit problems. So be a patriotic American. Right? I mean, if it's true, I mean, if what they're telling us is the absolute, we're absolutely dead broke, there's no money, we're going to go through bankruptcy, they're going to be shutting off the lights, you make the call. Do we ask Phil Mickelson to say, hey, you know, $43 million, chip in a couple of bucks, or I'm sorry, Granny, we're broke, no medicine, no food for you. Here's the curb, good luck, hope it works out, put out the red light maybe. No, we're not going to do that. In no country should we. And you look at France. I mean, a couple weeks ago, we talked about Gerard Depardieu, who didn't want to pay his taxes, so he went to Russia. Here's an idea, Phil. Why don't you go to Russia? The Evening Standard reported this, and over in the UK, and it's one of those things that just makes you go, wow. Maybe I could see it, you know, here in the U.S. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy, his home was raided by police. Evidently some fraud stuff going on, corruption stuff going on. He's under investigation. But while they were searching his home, they found that Sarkozy is planning to move to London. He's going to found a multi-billion-dollar hedge fund. He's got to do something. But here's the thing. You know, you look at this in the process of evading taxes for the super wealthy. You know, he's going to evade the investigation. Well, they went after him, and according to the article, if the move goes ahead, he could escape that top rate, which there in France is up to 75%. So the former president, the patriotic former president, I'm going to take my money and I'm going to leave. It's been reported he's been looking in the affluent area of South Kensington there in London. Celebrity couple, tax evading couple. And, you know, you think about Sarkozy, who, you know, upon taking office in 2007, his salary, personal salary, more than doubled. And now all those connections going to pay off handsomely. And you know, you don't really want to be taxed at that, right? You know, screw those working people. Which, it's amazing to me how many of the very wealthy think that way. Yeah, I go back to that. And you know, a friend of mine, you know, his father, back during the war, was proud of the fact that he could pay the 95% tax rate in London. He was proud of it. Patriotic. Helping the country. Now we've got people who are, but I'm leaving California. We're moving to a race to the bottom state. What the hell does that say about us? Let's take a quick break. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at therichsmithshow.com or Stitcher on your smartphone. Right back after this with Hour 3. Stick around.
Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Only 90% of the world.
smart policy. And sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As the nation honored Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy on Monday, the labor movement and the civil rights movement commemorated the solidarity that they share in the struggle for justice. In Memphis, during the sanitation workers' strike, just before an assassin's bullet struck him down, Dr. King talked about dignity for workers in Memphis and in the United States.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor.
In 1968, Dr. King told SEIU 1199 members that he walked many picket lines for justice for workers. He said solidarity and struggle is what will win social and economic justice for workers.
Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. We are going to demand what is ours. And my friends, the resources are here in America. The question is whether the will is here. If we will stand and work together, we will bring into being that day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
At Wisconsin's commemoration of Dr. King, the widow of the late former father James Groppi criticized Governor Scott Walker for his attack on unions as she accepted an award for her late husband. Margaret Rozga spoke as the governor sat nearby.
As the widow of a man who, after we married, not only drove bus but became the president of Local 998 Amalgamated Transit Union, as a person who remembers that Martin Luther King was killed while he was working to organize sanitation workers, I know that anyone who works to curtail union rights is not in the tradition of Martin Luther King.
Coca-Cola workers in Germany are spilling out of their plants and onto picket lines to protest flexible working hours. Jesse Russell reports.
Flexible working hours and better wages have Coca-Cola employees walking the picket lines all across Germany. The workers are engaging in a series of warning strikes in advance of continued contract negotiations with the company. The strikes are taking place at the 50 Coca-Cola bottling plants throughout Germany. The union has called the strikes in protest of the threat of staff reductions and the introduction of flexible working hours, which could include mandatory weekend shifts. Negotiations are set to continue on January 30th, but so far there's been little sign of movement from the company. The workers are represented by the Beverages and Catering Industry Trade Union, which has argued that the plant workers have sacrificed by going years without wage increases.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to these, to the NLRB and other agencies.
It really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Ah, yes, what a wonderful world it would be if the robber barons could roam the earth with the power and the iron fist of the, of, you know, just 100 years ago. Take us back to the good old days, the 1880s, 1890s, you know, the good old days, where workers had no rights, where you take what you're given. And if you dare utter that U word, blacklisted, blackballed. And in just a couple of days, the whole case over yellow dog contracts, we're going to talk about that. You know, you sign that contract, the only way you'll get this job is you sign it, you'll never, ever, ever consider joining a labor union. That's our history. And the right in this country wants to take us back to that. The Republicans are with this whole no rights at work agenda, pushing as hard as they can and heavily funded. So in the coming days and weeks, we're going to hear a lot, and we've heard an awful lot about this group called the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. The right has gotten tons of mileage off of, well, misinformation. Because that's what they thrive on. But we're going to hear an awful lot because they're going to need another appointee, and the Republicans have said in the past, they're going to block anything Obama does, so we will see, which is why I've asked Professor John Logan, a professor at San Francisco State University, where he is the Director of Labor and Employment Studies there at San Francisco State University. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. Glad to be on.
You know, I look at this, and again, you know, we've been talking about for a couple of years now about the National Labor Relations Board, and, you know, I still think that Boeing should not have been allowed to do what they did moving to South Carolina without negotiating that, especially with the threat of you do what we say or we're moving. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. But you know, the media has picked up on all of the worst lies and distortions about this group in my thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, you're right to talk about it in the context of, you know, what's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan and elsewhere as well. Because as soon as the Republicans took over the House after the 2010 election, one of the first things they did was to start these politically motivated attacks on the NLRB. And, you know, they did it even before Boeing, but Boeing, you know, the fact that the General Counsel dared to try to enforce the law and issued a complaint against Boeing became the focus of their attacks. And then subsequently they attacked the board for trying to get rid of the worst cases of delay in union certification elections, because it's very well documented that employers use delay as a deliberate tactic to undermine employee free choice. They attacked the board for daring to require employers to post notices informing workers of their rights under federal law, and both the election rule and the notice posting rule are currently on hold because of legal challenges by employers and by the Republican Party. And then they attacked President Obama's recess appointments to the board, even although the reason that he had to go down the route of appointing board members by recess was that Republican senators were refusing to allow a vote on any of his Democratic nominations to the board. So, you know, it's just this ludicrous situation where they attack the board for trying to let people know their rights. They attack the president for making recess appointments when they gave him no choice but to make recess appointments. And they even tried to block the recess appointments by holding these sham pro forma sessions in the Senate and said it wasn't really in recess. And so now they have a legal challenge to the legitimacy of the recess appointments. And so this is just continuing indefinitely. You know, we had a report at the end of the last year, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Darrell Issa's committee, put out this absolutely ridiculous report on the NLRB's so-called, you know, metamorphosis from independent regulator to dysfunctional union advocate was what they called it. And, you know, I mean, just to quote one line to let you know how you know, completely you know, on the absolute far right fringe these people are now. Their criticism says that the NLRB appears to be sacrificing fairness to job creators in order to promote pro-union policies. I mean, you know, I mean, these people seem to have either don't realize that the purpose of the board is to protect workers' rights and to make sure that those rights are not violated, are, you know, more likely that they just fundamentally don't agree with the rights protected by federal labor law anymore, that they don't actually want people to have an effective right to organize and engage in collective bargaining.
Well, do you think the right ever did? I mean, at the end of the day, you're still talking about the arm of the business class,
yeah,
who, you know, they absolutely don't, never wanted it. They basically had it thrust upon them by,
right,
by people who said, you know, we want a little bit of the wealth we create.
Right. No, I agree with that, but, you know, in the last 2 years, they've definitely sort of smelled blood, so to speak, you know, and they think both at the state level and at the federal level, they can really use this issue to fundamentally weaken unions and to drive down labor standards and to drive down wages and all of the benefits that people have, you know, worked so hard to get over the past 5 or 6 decades. I mean, you know, they're really out to try and finish off, you know, to completely get rid of the political influence that unions and working people have, and to get rid of any meaningful influence that they have at the workplace too.
You know what I find interesting is you didn't hear the Republicans complaining about the NLRB during the Bush years when they were using it as a means to crush working conditions and a means to destroy the right to, and I remember the Kentucky River cases, you know, where they basically redefined who a supervisor was. So even if you do 10 minutes of supervisory work a week, you're out of the bargaining unit.
Yeah. And some workplaces, you know, you have this crazy situation where you have more supervisors than you have ordinary employees. I mean, it's just a nonsense and, you know, clearly not what was intended by the original act. And as you say, you know, they conveniently forget that the most extreme labor boards that we've ever had in the history of the NLRB were during the 1980s and during the 2000s under the Reagan era and then under Bush too. And even, you know, going back to the 1950s, you know, the first truly political pro-employer labor board we had was during the Eisenhower administration. But, you know, that was, you know, today would be considered fairly moderate compared with the Republican boards that we've had since then. And, you know, now we have this board that's trying to do some good stuff. You know, it's trying to restore just a sort of modicum of balance in our labor policy, you know, considering, as you said, the extreme decisions that we had under the previous administration. And, you know, but even these very sort of moderate changes are, you know, for Republicans just completely unacceptable now. They won't accept anything that challenges the sort of stranglehold that employers have over the union certification system.
Is it possible to have this, you know, the NLRB just being an oversight body that's somehow non-political, so you don't have these massive this massive swing in ideology? I mean, when we came out of the Bush years, I mean, the NLRB was almost an arm of the Chamber of Commerce, if I can make that analogy.
Sure.
Because, you know, you look at this and you go, the folks on the right have, and you listen to the Romney campaign, he believed that regulatory agencies were, you know, these businesses were their clients, and they had to walk hand in hand together. And it's not your job to oversee; it's to, you know, it's to actually work with them instead of being the cop on the beat. I think that's a fundamental flaw in their thinking on this agency. Or am I missing something?
Yeah. Well, the thing about the NLRB too. I mean, you're absolutely right. But the thing about the labor boards, you know, to listen to the Republican criticism and the criticism of the chamber and the National Association of Manufacturers and all of these other, never mind, you know, the far right, you know, the anti-union organizations, the super PACs whose main function these days seems to be to destroy unions. If you listen to what they say, you would think that the NLRB was this incredibly powerful, regulatory agency that, you know, had this agenda to you know, revolutionize workplace relations. And the reality is, because the courts have decided so many major issues, the power, the influence of the board over labor policy is more constrained now than it ever has been before in the 78-year history of the board. And the court decisions have almost all been in one direction, and that's, you know, against workers' collective rights. So on any major issue about employer union access to the workplace, employer so-called free speech rights, to have these sort of very coercive anti-union meetings at the workplace and so on, all of the decisions have been decided in employers' favor, and that means that, the board is really restricted now, it's constrained to sort of tinkering around the edges of our labor policy. So the current board is trying to do some good things. I mean, things that are long overdue, are desperately needed, and are, absolutely reasonable and moderate. And yet, it won't make a huge difference, regrettably. I mean, we really need to think again about the entire law. And if we really think that people should have the right to organize at the workplace, think about how we're going to make that right effective. Because there's very little that the board can actually do that would, as I said before, loosen the stranglehold anti-union employers have over the system. And yet, if you were to listen to these characters, the Republicans in Congress and the Chamber and all of the anti-union groups, you would think that this was a tremendously powerful agency.
I hear it all the time. They're tyrannical. Yeah, they want employers. Can you believe they want employers to post your rights? Can you believe that?
Yeah. And, we've spoken about this before, but it's worth saying again. One of the interesting things about that case is that the Chamber of Commerce filed a lawsuit. There were several lawsuits, but one of them was by the Federal Chamber of Commerce. And what it said was, this is an infringement upon our free speech rights because we don't agree with what we're being asked to post. But what they're being asked to post is the law of the land. What they're being asked to post is federal labor law, Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, saying that workers have a right to organize and bargain collectively. So they're basically saying, we don't agree with the law of the land. We don't think that workers should be told that they have these rights. And, part of me wishes that we could somehow use that case to have a debate, a sort of national debate about, do people really think that workers should have those rights or not? And, I'm absolutely confident, despite all of the setbacks that we've had in the last couple of years, that people do believe fundamentally that, workers ought to have the right to organize and bargain collectively. And, if they do believe that, then it's a question of how to make it effective. But, it's just, this crazy situation where, even requiring employers to post a notice saying that these are your rights is unacceptable now to the anti-union folks.
Yeah, it's incredible to me. Last line of questioning I've got for you. You see these big companies in other countries like Germany where, they're unionized and the companies operate in it and they're fine with it. And both sides do very well. Everybody prospers. But yet here, not so much.
Right, and those very same companies, interestingly, when they come over here, they behave exactly the same way as Walmart or any other big anti-union employer, because the law allows them. If they know that the law is ineffectual, if they know that the penalties for violating the law are a joke, then even companies like Mercedes, BMW, Nissan. If you look at the UAW's campaign at the moment to organize Nissan in Mississippi, there's no doubt that those workers in Mississippi, if they were given a free and uncoerced choice, they would flock into unions. They would, they would join the UAW in a moment. But if it wasn't for the fear and intimidation at the workplace, so you have the situation where you have all of these big multinational companies that work cooperatively with unions in Europe, respect workers' rights, and then when they come here, they violate workers' rights, and they operate non-union just because they can, because here the law doesn't protect that right. And there's so many of those cases. You have with T-Mobile workers who are trying to join the Communication Workers of America, owned by Deutsche Telekom. They cooperate with unions in Germany, but not in the United States.
And again, I keep talking about the broken nature of our labor law, and here another example of that. Professor Logan, it's always great talking with you.
Yeah.
I appreciate the time.
Happy to be on. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Because I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Tap and Diggin, Mr. Harlequin Hall, and Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a lot of long and an 80 short day for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Tap and Diggin, Mr. Harlequin Hall, because I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
The once haughty Tea Party has been whittled down to only a nub of its former self, with only 8% of Americans now identifying themselves with a faction. And no wonder. The fiery movement that sprang from legitimate anger over the government bailout of Wall Street banksters quickly got co-opted by Republican political operatives fronting for those same banksters and for such corporate extremists as the Koch brothers. By brandishing the plutocratic agenda of those elites, the party's popular support has dwindled to a nub that's nutty, focusing on what one Republican leader calls tinfoil hat issues. For example, a top agenda item for today's withered Tea Party is a full-bore howling assault on something that isn't even there, a nefarious United Nations plot to destroy American freedom and establish a UN dictatorship over us. Yes, the same international debating society that the right wing used to mock as meek and weak is presently being recast as a fearsome totalitarian behemoth brazenly stripping our sovereignty from us. The UN's weapon is not some secret army, but a piece of paper. Titled Agenda 21, it's just a series of non-binding UN recommendations to encourage sustainable economic growth in developing nations through voluntary actions. It's an innocuous document with zero force behind it, passed way back in 1992 with the support of Republican President George Bush. Some threat. But in recent months, Agenda 21 was turned into a foaming-at-the-mouth cause by the nattering nabob of nuttiness, Glenn Beck. So Beck's disciples have been waving the tattered Tea Party banner and rushing to the barricades to, by God, defend America from this piece of paper. This is Jim Hightower saying, the wonder is that even 8% of the public has stuck with the Tea Party.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. This whole gun thing has just got me scratching my head. And you're going to see a lot of craziness coming out, a lot of, we should have the custodians with guns, and we should have all of this stuff. Everybody should have a gun. And I see this, wow. I guess only in South, well, I shouldn't say only in South Carolina. I'm sure there's someone who's just as insane here in Pennsylvania. With this idea that the more guns we have, the safer we are. This is the argument of Republican State Senator Lee Bright, who, if everybody's got a gun, we're all safe. And I truly don't believe that. And you look at what happened today at down in Texas, an argument, bang, bang. Like when I was a kid, people had guns. They were throwing shots at each other. Like, angry, throw shots at each other. Bang, bang. But this guy went a little bit further. And, I'm not against people learning gun safety. Not at all. But this is a bit far from it. The senator said, we've got football, we've got basketball, and we've got baseball. He said, I think if they had a hunting team, it'd be a great idea. We need shooting teams. And I started thinking about this because they want to offer a course, the South Carolina Gun Safety Program, because he believes the more training we can get on the history of our nation, the founding of our nation, the better. And again, I'm not sure how that equates to guns, because I don't quite buy the right-wing thinking on the Second Amendment. Because here again, I go back to the militia. I go back to well-regulated discipline. I go back to that whole thing and think about, the founding of the country and the fear of oppression and all. And I kind of wonder, not so in line in a well-regulated militia, meaning you're in the militia. Not so this whole, I should have everything I want mentality, and they should be everywhere. I don't know that the founders would have come down on that. And this idea that if everybody has a gun, it's going to stop bad things from happening. And I think about that woman from Reading every once in a while, who made national news because she went to her 6-year-old's soccer game with a sidearm. Visible for everyone to see. And of course, people are freaked out. You're a bunch of kids playing soccer. There you are with a 9mm. And if, as one of my gun friends says, who, this is one of the things that a gun does is the element of surprise. So by displaying it, you're automatically heightening, anyone who will do you harm's awareness and taking away that element of surprise. And I think about her because, here was somebody had the guns. Should have been safe, right? Yet in the holster hanging on the chair, as I remember the report, sat her gun as her husband shot her in the back of the head. And you go, well, where do we go with this? Do we, as Representative James Lankford, say it's poor people's fault? It's that welfare mother. He was asked by a constituent, which, you kind of go, I've been hearing this a lot. It's the drugs. This guy says, my question is regarding the guns, and is Washington at all aware of the psychotropic drugs that these children are taking? I guarantee it 100%. That's our big problem. And Lankford goes into this long explanation, going, well, I agree with him, right there with you. It's a bunch of issues, quite frankly, most liberals are afraid to talk about. One of them is psychiatric drugs. He says, we've over-medicated kids, quite frankly. Some of the over-medication of our kids are because welfare moms want to get additional benefits. Again, a very, very right-wing meme. It's the welfare queen. He goes on to say, and if they can put them on SSI through maintenance drugs, they can also put them on Social Security disability and get a separate check. It's the greed of the welfare queen. Didn't you know? Duh, I should have known. And that's an easy way to write it off. You know, you look at the gun violence in this country, and you go back. It's the gun, right? You know, the shooting that happened today in Texas. As I understand it, people are arguing. Yeah, I just wrote a report a couple of days ago up here, just a little bit north of where our studio is. People are driving on the highway. Guy's waving a gun at the other driver. More guns means more of that. I'm not against law-abiding citizens having carry permits. I'm not against it. If you feel safer with it, I do believe that there needs to be strong enforcement. You do something dumb with a gun, you pay for it. You're responsible for that gun, wherever it goes. And you're responsible for what happens to it. If someone steals it, you got to report it. I don't know how difficult that is. I mean, if your car ended up missing, you would probably report it, right? Just a thought. And I agree with some of the military people who've come out and say, you know what, you don't need assault weapons, which I found hysterical. You know, you look at the big gun appreciation day that happened over the weekend. And how many shootings were there on Gun Appreciation Day? I mean, it's okay. Oh, three, four, five. Appreciate your gun. And then you got this Tea Party congressman, this Yoho from Florida. Said, wow, you know, when you read the Second Amendment, is that the militia had the same equipment as the military to protect them against tyrannical government? And I'm going, wait a second, you dimwit. The militia was the military, not the same as it was. And I go back to my learning of history, which was the founders feared standing armies. They feared our nation having a standing army. Why? I think Iraq, Afghanistan, I think the 90 countries around the world, I think our presence everywhere kind of goes in line with the founders. I think George Washington was right. Stay clear of foreign entanglements. I think he was dead on. They knew a standing army would mean, hey, we paid all this money for it, we should use it. Which is what we're doing. The only branch of the service, the military service that we have now that was supposed to be a standing branch of the military was the Navy. That's it. And why is that? Shipping lines. Pure and simple. But you don't hear the gun nuts going crazy about that, do you? Let's take a quick break right back after this with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around.
For the homeless or the poor, who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Oh, yeah, the big controversy. You know, it's amazing how nothing, how something inconsequential, how something really just not all that important dominates our news cycle. Did Beyonce lip sync? And my first thing was, who gives a damn if she did? Now, having sat where I did and saw the military, the band not really playing, and me and the guy there in the front row kind of having the staring contest, kind of thought that, but who cares? Who cares? Not me. Let's find out what Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, thinks about it from D.C. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much.
So do you care if Beyonce lip-synced?
Well, actually, I was very moved by her singing, and I'm not normally moved by renditions of the national anthem, and I kind of did. I felt like I'd been conned.
You were cheated.
If she did, and now the Marine Band seems to be backing off its original claim.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I was just a couple of feet away from them, and the one guy and I, we had this weird staring contest kind of thing going on, and I didn't think he was playing.
Well, that's part of the story now, is that they may not have been playing.
I thought he was just angry for me looking at him. So we
they may not have been playing.
We got into this angry eye staring thing, and then finally, you know, something went boom, and he looked away, and that was kind of the end of it.
Weird.
Yeah, I had really good seats, I guess, and, you know, a working class stiff like me shouldn't be in a place like that. I felt very uncomfortable there. Not my world.
Well, that's very nice that you got such great seats. How did that come about?
Well, I got them. Your boss Ellen got them for me. It was very nice. Got us into the area there, and you know we were just 20 feet away from where the president was standing.
Wow.
Maybe a little more. Maybe 22. But I guess it's just I felt like I shouldn't be there.
Well, you were so. Yeah. Enjoy and remember.
Yeah, I would have, it's one of those things. One of those things you look back on, and maybe in 30 years I'll go, wow, that was incredible. It is what it is, I guess. But did you go or did you sit home and watch it on television?
No, I stayed home.
Probably the best seat.
Yeah.
Didn't have to deal. I do have one problem with the whole event. I was not more than 20, 25 feet away from the president. Now, granted, there was a huge bulletproof glass around him. So, the screening to get in, not what I would consider all that invasive. And in fact, kind of left me going, why didn't they screen me?
That's interesting.
Got a much, much more thorough screening at the little airport here in Harrisburg than I got going into the one of the better seats in the area.
Wow.
Now, I didn't open my eyeglass case, didn't open the guy's laptop bag in front of me. Just kind of made me. Now, I guess, these are the big wigs. These are the Washington insiders, I guess, that I was around there with. And maybe you don't want to upset them too much. But I walked away going, I got a much better exam at the airport.
Wow.
And, I was expecting, strip search. And I got, do you have anything? They didn't make me take my belt off. Which is one of those things you go, the airport, jeez.
Yeah, you expect it.
You leave your belt on, they beat you with it.
That's what they do. They're trained.
They are. Well, these are supposed to be, it is what it is. It was a good event. What was your thought of the speech?
I thought it was a very powerful, passionate, bold speech.
You didn't think it was political? You didn't think it was just a basic campaign speech?
No, I didn't think it was it had a very different tenor from his campaign speeches.
Yeah, some of the folks that I've talked to said, it's just more of his campaign rhetoric. And I go, there was something, I guess, in there a little bit for everybody, except for, the jobs thing that I didn't find as much as I wanted. And we'll see.
It's an inaugural speech. It is what it is.
Yeah, well, let's find out what's going on today. I see the general was cleared of any misconduct.
He was, General John Allen, who is the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan. And he's the one who got caught up in the scandal that prompted the resignation of CIA director David Petraeus,
yep,
who had to resign over an affair with his biographer Paula Broadwell. Well, remember, John Allen, the general, got caught up in this because it was found during the investigation of this that he'd been exchanging racy and flirtatious emails with Jill Kelly, the woman that Paula Broadwell harassed by email.
Okay. And is there anything wrong with him sending racy emails back and forth with a woman?
Well, he is married to somebody else, but it turns out, no. The Inspector General says he had not violated military prohibitions against conduct on becoming an officer. He has been completely exonerated.
Well, that's a good thing, I guess, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they say one U.S. official says some of the messages are not the sort of things you would print in the family newspaper, but that doesn't mean he violated military regulations by sending and receiving them. And also officials close to him say he didn't have a sexual relationship with him. And they also say that he was a close friend to Allen and his wife, that Kelly was a close friend to Allen and his wife, Kathy. And Kelly, she says that she copied his wife on several of the emails.
Yeah, maybe they were in on it all together. Maybe it was a
Maybe
a lot of group things going on there, which is what part of the rumor was as well with Petraeus and the other one, right?
I don't think so.
Well, you know, I've got friends who tell me big parties, lots of very highbrow stuff going on there.
I'm hoping that nothing like that was going on with Allen. With Petraeus, who knows what was going on?
And again, I keep talking about none of my business.
Exactly. It's not my business. It's only my business if it's something that impacts the way he was doing his job.
That's absolutely it. You know, where he puts his little general is his business.
And apparently it was not impacting the way he was doing his job.
Good. So, okay, now we can move on, or is this still a story?
No, that is it. He is exonerated. Done. The only thing is that his nomination to become a Supreme Allied Commander of Europe got held up in all this. So we don't know where that stands.
Well,
so that's rather messed up his career.
And as some of these things generally have a tendency to do.
They do.
Yeah. And speaking of little guns, it looks like more shootings today, huh? Texas, New Mexico, what's going on?
Yeah, more shootings today. Yeah. The Texas shooting was on a campus at a community college, and it was a fight between two people that led to this shooting, apparently, where a maintenance man was caught in the crossfire and wounded, and a fourth person was also taken to a hospital for a medical condition. The two people involved in the fight are considered people of interest, and they're not looking for any other suspects. They've recovered a handgun at the scene, so it's really very, very, very unpleasant. Equally unpleasant is the story. In fact, I don't know how you grade what's a more unpleasant shooting story. It's a hideous shooting story coming out of Albuquerque of this 15-year-old boy who's accused of killing his entire family, his mother, father, younger brother, and two young sisters, and then who reloaded the rifles and planned to go to a Walmart and randomly shoot people until he got taken out by the police.
Yeah, why not? I mean, once you've gone that far, why not?
Yeah.
And
He didn't do that part of it.
Yeah.
Instead, he went and hung out with his 12-year-old girlfriend for the day, who he told about this shooting because he'd also texted her a picture of his mother's bloody face after he'd killed her.
Wow. That's distressing. And the
I mean, it's beyond.
Wow. Wow. And there's just so many things that just run through my mind. I got a 10-year-old who we just gave a phone to, and she's texting all the time. And I can't imagine getting something like, man. Wow. And back to the Texas thing. I mean, you know, the NRA would say if that maintenance guy would have had a gun, there'd have probably been three or four more people shot.
Well, interestingly, Think Progress was reporting that Republicans in Texas, and I don't know whether this was local or whether this was statewide, had been considering allowing concealed carry permits on campus. And it sort of died with the end of the last legislature, but they're bringing it back after Newtown.
Yay, more guns. That's what we need. So when more people have arguments, we have more shootings.
Yeah, because what happened today was that somebody got caught in the crossfire.
And that would be my luck. You know, I had always had this view of, I don't care, you know, let people shoot each other if they want. But I've got the kind of luck where two people would get into an argument, they'd both pull the gun, and then they would both miss, and somehow I'd get shot by both of them.
Exactly.
That's my luck.
That's what can happen.
You know, I was just thinking about, you know, there was a woman here in our area who had made national news. She was the one who went to her 6-year-old daughter's soccer game, with a sidearm. And, you know, the local sheriff, you know, however you want to put it, stupidly or legally, whichever side of that you fall on, pulled her permit. And it became a huge national story. She was the big NRA poster child and all of this stuff. And, you know, about a year later, with the gun hanging on the chair behind her, her husband blew her head off in the house. And I'm going, you know, did the gun make you any safer?
You know, whoa!
I mean, it's just insane. All of these guns, all of this saturation, you know, that's how, it's the reason I don't own a gun. I mean, it's true. I grew up in a place where had I had one, there'd be either a lot of dead people or me in jail. Because
Well, it just helps. This boy lived in a house where there was a preponderance of guns. Yeah. One of the guns he picked up, by the way, to do the shooting in Walmart, and the one he killed his father with was an AR-15. He used other ones to kill the other family members. There were misses of guns in that house. Now, if there hadn't been any guns, he's 15, he would have had to work at it really hard to get the guns when he got ticked off with his mother, which is the only motive they've got so far, or he would have had to take a knife or a hammer and take out 5 people. That's a lot of work.
That is a lot. That's a full day's work.
Yes.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Alan. Guns don't kill people. People kill people, but the gun helps.
Exactly.
Yeah. Man, geez. And the thing is the more we hear about it, the more you see the crazy people say, they're going to come for our guns, and we need more of them. More is making, I don't know. Debt ceiling news, what's going on?
Debt ceiling news is very interesting. House Republicans will introduce a bill tomorrow to suspend the debt limit until the 19th of May.
Right.
And that's going to allow the Treasury Department to borrow to meet its obligations until after Senate Democrats pass a budget. Now then, if they don't, under the terms of the bill, members' pay will be withheld until they do pass it.
Okay.
Now, Chuck Schumer says, well, we're going to pass one. We're just going to do it. But what's really interesting here is that House Speaker John Boehner has told a group of 5 influential conservatives in the House that he would work towards a budget that balances in 10 years. And he'd also keep top-line spending down. And so these 5 members gave their okay. But other conservatives in the House have vowed that there will be, quote, hell to pay if leaders don't follow through on the agreement.
Hell to pay. You know, the thing is I don't understand why they feel the need to put all these negative things into these deals they know they're never going to follow. I mean, you think of all the things, the sequester, you think of the debt ceiling, you think of, you know, all of this stuff, the fiscal cliff, all of this stuff. They put all this really arcane, just really negative stuff in there, and then, well, they figure out a way around it. You know, the Millionaires Club, are they going to miss a couple of days' pay?
Well, probably not the senators. There are a few people in the House of Representatives who actually live off their pay. Not many, but a few.
Yeah. But they're not the ones who have the power and the ability to make sure things get done.
No, they're not. They're not at all.
And finally, what's going on with the the filibuster reform? Anything? Are we going to see anything? Are we going to see any movement? Will we hear people talking? Will we know who's doing the secret holds? Anything?
I think the secret holds are probably going to be got rid of. You're not going to have the talking filibuster. That's going to be got rid of. But Harry Reid got quite excited today. And basically, after everybody thought he was being all sort of quiet Harry Reid, you know, the sort of Harry Reid that you see just, you know, plodding about, he suddenly turned into the pugilist Harry Reid. And he said, giving them 24, 46 hours. That's it.
24, 46?
They've got 24, 46 hours to agree to a deal, or he's moving forward with the nuclear option.
24, 46. So how many days is that? 100?
It's all one day because they're only going to recess. It's all the same day. They're not adjourning the Senate.
Oh, okay. Because I'm thinking 2,446 hours, that's...
24 to 46 hours.
Oh, to 46. I thought you said 24, 46.
No, 24 to 46 hours.
Oh, good. Well, we'll see then.
Yeah.
I hope again, like I said earlier, why do they keep, you know, laying down these gauntlets when we know it's not going to happen? Let's see if it happens.
I think he's so cross with some of the things that Republicans did in the last Congress that he's going to follow through.
I hope so. I hope at some point the Democrats get upset and go, hey, people. And one of the things I hope Obama does is take to the soapbox and say, look, the last 4 years, nothing really has happened because these people have stopped it. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who made the observation that, you know, if it weren't for the fact that, you know, Obama's the black guy in the White House, do you really think all of these Tea Party types would put up with nothing being done? No infrastructure bills, no jobs bills, nothing to move the country forward? Do you think they would have really put up with that if it were a white guy sitting in there? And I don't know what the answer to it, but he's got a point.
Got a point.
It's insane. Victoria, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Earth, sky.
On January 8, 2013, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Climatic Data Center released the latest climate report for the year 2012.
It confirmed that 2012 was the warmest year ever recorded in the contiguous United States. The average temperature for the U.S. was 3.2 degrees Fahrenheit above 20th century average. 2012 beat 1998 as the warmest year ever recorded in the U.S. In general, 2012 brought the U.S. its fourth warmest winter, warmest spring ever recorded, second warmest summer, and a warmer than average fall.
We have a list of the extreme weather events that occurred in 2012 across the contiguous U.S. at our website, earthsky.org. Here are a few examples.
There have now been 9 consecutive 12-month periods that make up the 9 warmest such periods in the CONUS record. That's a record of soil characteristics, including temperature.
356 all-time record high maximum temperatures were known to be tied or broken in the U.S. in 2012.
Nearly 100 million people, about a third of the U.S. population, experienced 10 or more days of temperatures that reached or exceeded 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Plus, 8 of the past 10 warmest years ever recorded for the United States have occurred since 1990. We have more at earthsky.org. Search for the words warmest year on record. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
All around the bends. You could have a
Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of tonight's program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on the smartphone. Take your program on the go. Again, you know, I think about yesterday, the big inauguration. A lot of the reports I've seen trying to minimize, nobody was really paying attention. 22% of the people watched. I got to be honest with you. The people that I saw who were there, the folks that I talked to, this is the beginning of something new. And the hope is that the reports that I've seen are true. Maybe this is going to be a more progressive president. Maybe this is going to be a guy who's not going to be constrained by, constrained by having to run for re-election. Maybe, maybe he's seen the way. I don't know. As Randall said, you're getting very sleepy. You will forget about my corporatist senatorial voting record. I'm really a liberal. You are falling asleep. You are getting sleepy. Maybe Randall's right. Maybe we've been lulled into what we want. And we've been told and reinforced by the radical right that, you know, the guy in the White House is really this radical. And, you know, you listen to McConnell, you listen to the Republicans, they're really all on the same talking points, which is he's radical, he's a liberal communist, he's way out there. And the reality is corporate America has never done better. Wall Street should be praising this guy for saving them. All the while, you know, keeping at bay, you know, all those voices that are in the streets, those workers who want a better tomorrow, those people who are saying tax the wealthy people more, because that's what the country needs. And I wonder about, because I've had a number of these conversations where, well, you want to take from the people who've produced, which is nonsensical on so many levels. You know, you stop and you look at this and you go, you know, these are people who have lobbied. And look, they've got enormous wealth. And that enormous wealth has been used for more wealth. And how do they do that? Generally, going to Congress and lobbying, buying a politician. You know, what was the one quote that I loved a couple years back? You give a working man a tax break and he may go buy a toaster. You give a billionaire a tax break and he's going to buy a congressman. And there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, you look at the policy, you look at the direction of the last 30 years. Well, you know, the last 30 years at least. Has there been anything that's benefited you and me in the last 30 years? Anything that solely for us? I mean, every time they raise the minimum wage, it always comes with a pound of flesh. We've got to give up something. And I look right now, you know, here in Pennsylvania, the whole no rights at work agenda, front and center. They've come up with their, I don't even know, open work initiative, which I'm still trying to figure out the wording. I mean, it sounds, you know, it's beautiful. It's very Orwellian. It's the open work initiative. It's open. And there's work. And it's an initiative, of course. What it really means is you have you have an open initiative to work for free, basically. It means tearing down conditions. It means dividing. Strange times we live in, folks. And at the end of it, it's going to come down to you and me not being bamboozled, not being BS'd, not being misled. And it comes with information, and it comes with thinking through the BS that they're feeding us. I know Metcalf's off the deep end. The guy that scares me is Bloom. Because, you know, I've talked to people who think, oh, well, he seems so rational. Those are the people who are scary. Metcalf, you know, is off the beaten path. You know he's the extremist, pushing the agenda. It's people like Bloom that are scary. Because, hey, seems rational. Not so much. Just as destructive. Just a different way of going about it. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast at thericksmithshow.com. We'll be back here tomorrow picking this up right where we left off every weeknight. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rage.